Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Museum of Science, where their new exhibit, Changing Landscapes, An Immersive Journey, transports you to iconic spots around the globe to see how people are adapting to a changing climate. More at mos.org. And Eastern Bank, committed to helping people and businesses prosper by investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio. Senator Elizabeth Warren joins us in just a couple of minutes. The U.S. has never defaulted on its debt. This would be the first. We'll discuss that, unaffordable child care, challenges to student loan forgiveness, and other uplifting topics with the senator. Then we'll open the lines to hear from you about the sorry state of child care right here in Massachusetts.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Retired federal judge Nancy Gertner is back for On the Docket. She'll touch on the latest on the Supreme Court, plus the five fired Memphis police officers charged with second-degree murder of 29-year-old Tyree Nichols. All that and more ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We normally would be at the library on Friday, but we had technical problems, and so I regret to say we are not there.
Remember when Mark said there's nothing like good planning? This is Groucho, and this is nothing like good planning. That's what it was. Our sincere apologies. There were a ton of people there to see Senator Warren, even at 9:30. We'll make it up to you, the senator said, too. By the way, we will be back at the library, and I'll be working on Tuesday. We have our first Ask the New Governor, Healy, noon to 1, and in an odd time for us, from 1:30 to 2:30, it'll be Ask the Mayor with Michelle Wu. But now we're joined in Brighton by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Hello there, Senator. How are you?
Hello. Good to be
with you.
Thanks
for coming out. Yeah.
Really, you bet.
But
I sure wish we were at the library.
Yeah, well,
we had a big crowd at the library waiting for you, and we feel really bad about it. But anyway, you are here, so thank you very much for being here. Let's talk about the debt ceiling first. You wrote a piece for the Globe calling the Republican con on the debt ceiling. That was the headline. What do you mean?
Well, let's start with the fact that the Republicans really don't care about the national debt. And talk about all the evidence that lines that up. First of all, we wouldn't be having a so-called debt ceiling crisis, that is, need to raise the debt, if it hadn't been for just two things. If the Republicans had not jammed through the Donald Trump tax cuts that went mostly to the billionaires and the giant corporations. And secondly, if they hadn't hollowed out the IRS, so the odds of a multimillionaire or billionaire being audited were cut by half. Just those two things alone, if those hadn't happened, we wouldn't hit the debt ceiling until after Joe Biden's first term. So this has been manufactured by the Republicans. But here's the deal. They are saying, yeah, we really care about the debt ceiling. What's the very first thing they pass? Take money away from the IRS, which means it's going to increase the national debt. And then they say, we have such a plan. They want to put a 30% national sales tax in place on everything from rent to groceries to diapers to car repairs, and give a massive tax cut to the richest people in this country. That's not serious about trying to reduce the national debt.
You know, Senator, when I watch on C-SPAN or whatever, let me be as polite as I can. There are a bunch of dopes in Congress. And I'm serious. I am not convinced that a lot of the Republicans, the Boberts, the Taylor Greens, even know that this is money that Congress voted already to spend.
Right.
I mean, that's not... I'm right, am I not?
You are totally right.
No, not just about the concept, but that they don't get it.
Well, they don't get it. And here's the interesting question. They don't get it because they can't get it, or they don't get it because they don't want to get it. You know, these are people who came into Congress, and they got one goal in mind in this two-year period, and that is plow the ground so Donald Trump can get reelected. Right? Want to bring Donald Trump back. That's their, and they made this very clear. And they embrace the chaos Because they think that's going to be the best path for Donald Trump. And you know who's told him that's the best path?
Donald Trump.
No, it's true. Donald Trump has already said, we've got the stuff on it where he says, you know why the red wave didn't occur, according to Donald Trump? The American people weren't feeling enough pain. But we're going to fix that between now and 2024.
You know, Senator, I don't mean this to sound accusatory. I don't understand once, maybe you have, why someone like you doesn't lead a charge to just get rid of the damn thing.
Oh,
why do we even discussion?
I am there.
Are you referring to me with that comment? I want to be clear.
I'm
thank you. Okay,
yes,
fine.
Yes.
Thank you.
I am totally there. Of course we should get rid of the debt ceiling. And there are 58 different ways you could do it. You just repeal the damn thing. Mm. Or you could say, whenever you authorize spending, which is what we've done,
you're automatically
committed to spend.
Exactly.
You are automatically changing the debt ceiling for whatever it takes to accommodate that.
Is President Biden correct when he says he's going to refuse to negotiate about this, talk about this?
Well, the way I see it is he's saying, guys, put on the table what you want. Show us where your cuts are. Show us how you're planning to lay out this economy going forward, which, of course, Kevin McCarthy and the Republicans can't do because their only answer is right back where Jim was. Chaos, chaos, chaos. The idea that we're going to go in and start talking about cuts to Social Security, cuts to Medicare, cuts to things that matter to middle-class families, working families across this country, at a time when the Republicans are just bent on protecting tax breaks for the richest and the most powerful, that's a non-starter.
We're talking to Senator Elizabeth Warren, sadly, in Brighton. We're glad she's here in Brighton, but next time we'll be at the library. You know, Senator, there was a great piece in the Washington Post that described the White House as a Warren-infused White House in terms of a lot of the policies you championed both as a senator and a presidential candidate. One of the ones you had a plan for, you may have heard that expression, was about child care, which is a nightmare everywhere, including here in Massachusetts, despite the best efforts, or at least some efforts on the part of Beacon Hill. Can you remind people what your plan was and tell us what are the prospects for doing anything on this in the foreseeable future?
So we need child care all across this country. And we just got to start with the fact that the economics of the system don't work. This is not like going out to buy shoes or going out to buy food. This is a situation where families who need child care can't afford to pay more. They just can't. They're already stretched to the edges. Child care is beyond the means of a lot of people who would like to work. And so watch what happens to the economics. They don't work. They stay out of the workforce. And what does that mean? That means much more pressure. Small businesses, I meet with small businesses right here. And they say, I need more workers. What's the number one thing that would help you get more workers? Child care. If I could get more parents, usually mamas, in here, it would work. But here's the other half of that. Child care workers are paid so far below not just the responsibilities they take on, it's just not enough to live on. So you end up with a situation, even before the pandemic, you were getting a 30% turnover in child care workers, people who want to work in child care, but they're going to make more money working at the gas station three blocks down from the child care center. And so they leave in order to try to support their families. The only way we're going to make this work is to actually put money into it and help build out those child care centers all across the country. We need safe, affordable, available child care for every family. And we're going to get that when we actually spend the money to make it happen.
And you had a cap of X percent, 7% or something.
7%.
On the amount that could be spent on child care.
You know,
the amount that a family could spend on child care.
What's really frustrating to me, and I'm sure to you, is that this situation for child care hasn't changed much since you had children and I had children. My oldest daughter's 37. This is a long time ago. We're getting almost nowhere, it seems. Talk about how far behind we are the rest of the world.
So, Marjorie, that's the part that really gets me. I've told this story before, and I won't tell it again here. But I almost fell off the track by not going back to school because I couldn't get child care, and then quitting my first full-time teaching job, something that was really hard to get. And, you know, look, maybe someday I would have gone back, but I think about the fact, how many women in my circumstances, got knocked off the track and never got back on. And it affects them all the way through the years to their retirement because they have less money in retirement. Right. Because they couldn't do the work they wanted to do, they trained to do. But here's what gets me. Same thing's true for my daughter. And now the same thing is becoming true for my granddaughter. And as a nation, we are now 35 of the 37th richest countries. We are number 35. Yay, we're number 35 in terms of what we spend on our children, on our babies. And you don't build a future as a nation by underinvesting in your very best resource, that is underinvesting in your own children.
And by the way, the naive question I ask almost every time I see you, even though the Republicans don't want to spend money, is there one constituent that a Republican has who would not like to see more affordable? I'm serious. I really don't get it. I understand the philosophy, if there is one. I don't understand the real world lack of pressure on these people to do something.
But you know, Jim, what you're really identifying is childcare is one of these. But there are multiple places. Corporate taxation, where kind of the whole country gets it. The Stock Act, people in Congress should not be trading in stocks while they're making laws. There are these whole areas where you just can't get something through a Congress where Republicans are saying no, 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 no. And yet they're very popular. I make the argument often. A progressive agenda is America's agenda. It's things that are popular around the country. They're just not very popular in Washington.
You say that almost every day, the woman standing to your right.
Yeah, Americans are on the side of things like child care and climate
and more
change
affordable
and
college and
Supreme
debt
Court
relief.
On the wrong
and, yep,
side.
Supreme Court, abortion.
Now, we have a little task for you. You've told other people you're running for re-election, but you can only tell our listeners you're running for re-election if you do what Mike Lee does and use pathetic lyrics from Taylor Swift songs. To say it. Can you do that or you not?
No,
you cannot.
I can't.
But you are running for re-election.
But I am running for re-election.
Fine. Speaking of Taylor Swift, what do you think should happen with Ticketmaster and Live Nation?
Whoa! So for openers. Oh, okay. I love this stuff. Come on, I'm a nerd. Don't laugh at me. For openers, this is a reminder of what it means not to enforce antitrust laws, competition laws, for 40 years now. And I'm saying Democrat and Republican administrations, both, have just kind of given a free pass in one industry after another for the big boys to get together. The most recent of that was Live Nation and Ticketmaster. And here's the thing. They make it through the antitrust hurdles by promising. Oh, they're going to lower costs and they're going to give more accessibility. They're going to have all these marvelous efficiencies. And then, of course, you see what happens. Because when you've got a monopoly like they do, or a near monopoly like they do, they're able to offer terrible service at high prices. So I think this starts by the federal government actually has the power to do this. Going back and looking at that last merger, and at least let's do a careful application of the law and see if it might be appropriate to break them up.
Yeah.
You missed an opportunity to say, and if they did that, things would be all too well. You know, we're talking to Senator Elizabeth Warren. Senator, affordability is a huge thing with you all the time. Mm-hmm. Mayor Wu is in the midst of compiling a proposal that she pledged on her and during her campaign to put a local option rent stabilization measure before the legislature. For people, I think it's fairly obvious. Individual communities should have passed and be signed by Governor Healey. Individual communities could opt in, could opt out. Do you support that?
Yeah. Look, we're in an emergency situation. I wish, let's start this way. Our problem is we've got a supply problem. We just don't have enough housing. We don't have enough housing in the greater Boston area. We don't have enough housing in central Mass. We don't have enough housing in western Mass. We don't have enough housing across this nation. Best estimate is we need about 7 million more housing units. And when I talk about housing, I mean across the board. I mean housing for first-time home buyers, young people who are getting started. I mean housing for veterans. I mean housing for seniors who need a different kind of housing than the kind they've had for the last 35 years. I mean housing for people who literally are living on the streets right now. We need more housing.
And developers say more housing is not going to happen if rent control or rent stabilization is to happen. You appear to think they're wrong.
Yeah.
Well, why are they wrong?
Well, look, right now we're not getting enough housing. There are a lot of ways, and I get it. We need developers to help build. This is not simply somehow this stuff is going to happen because you water it. You know, we need developers to help make this happen. But there are a lot of things that are affecting development. So, for example, zoning laws, building codes that differ from Brighton to Cambridge to Medford, which just drives up the cost of getting a plumber anywhere. So there are a lot of pieces, auxiliary dwelling units out on the Cape. You put a little money on the table. This is something I'm working on really hard right now. And you get more people who say, you know, maybe we'll go ahead and build above the garage and then we'll have something for year round people who want to live out on the Cape, something more for people who work out there. I think of it this way, Jim. There is no single answer to how we're going to get 7 million more housing units. But you got to push in that direction. But in the meantime, you got to offer some relief to families who are just getting crushed.
We're talking to Elizabeth Warren out here in Brighton.
You know, Senator, you talked about in states that have outlawed or practically outlawed abortions, having abortions available in VA hospitals. Mm-hmm. Is that still a live proposal or what's going on with that?
Oh, we're in. So you are right, Marjorie. This is something I raised as soon as the decision came down in Dobbs, that the VA has a legal responsibility and authority to provide the full range of health care services to veterans. So I called the head of the VA and said, you got to step up here. And I get it that you hadn't. I don't want to point fingers about where it's been in the past. It's what's happening now, and the VA has announced that they are changing their policy and they are offering abortion services to veterans who need it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Elizabeth Warren, every time I look at you, I think I have a plan. So, I'm sorry. I mean, you said it about 10,000 times,
hey,
so it worked. I got
but
it.
But plans are good.
Okay, when this Supreme Court kills affirmative action, which I assume it will in June, and when this Supreme Court, in my opinion, likely figures out a way to undo the student loan forgiveness that people like you and Congresswoman Presley impressed on the president and ultimately did it up to a cap of $20,000. What's the plan B on either front to get relief to borrowers who are drowning in student debt and to ensure that there's some diversity in higher education?
Actually, you know, you're right, and these two are going to link to each other. Let me just start by saying, if the Supreme Court applies the law as it is written, then debt cancellation will go through. I don't have any doubt about that. The problem now is I'm worried about a Supreme Court that is playing politics instead of law. So what are we going to be able to do instead? And the answer is, I want to say more than anything else, we're not giving up on this. We still have a legislature. We still have other tools at the administrative level. But now is not the time to talk about Plan B, because now is the time to keep banging on the Supreme Court and say, apply the law as it is written.
Yeah, but we're going to, you know, one of the things, even when I hear people like you with unbridled optimism about what Congress can do if the people rise up and if you and your colleagues have the will, this Supreme Court is a young Supreme Court, and its right-wing nature is embodied in 52-year-olds, 53-year-olds, who could be there for, I don't know, 30 years.
I was thinking 111 years.
Well, whatever
it
is.
It's what it's going to feel like.
So
yeah.
Realistically, I mean, Nancy Gertner is going to join us at noon. She and Tribe were on the presidential commission. They went in believing in term limits. They came out believing in expansion of the court. When are the Democrats going to take a lead on doing something to create greater balance in a right-leaning, and that's being euphemistic, Supreme Court?
So I'm there on expanding the court. And for exactly the reason you identify. I'm a law professor, or was, and taught law for a long time. So you talk about something like changing the makeup of the United States Supreme Court in some way other than people die and other people come on. And it frizzles my eyelashes. I'm like, ah! And yet, when you've got a court that has now been taken over by this kind of right-wing, out-of-touch extremist political agenda and that they are aggregating power to themselves. You know, courts, this was always about the three parts of government. The big constraint on courts is courts just, you know, bring me the case and I will make the narrowest decision and I will try to be bound by stare decisis. This court is just hauling off. And we see Dobbs because that one is very visible. But God, they've gutted unions. They're doing everything they can just to take away the power of unions to be able to organize. They're doing everything they can, as you say, giving every signal that affirmative action is going to be out the door.
But you know, realistically, if there was a vote on the Senate floor today, even with 51 Democrats, would you have 30 votes if that?
You know, Jim, you don't have any votes if you don't start talking about it, fighting for it, explaining it. You got to socialize this stuff. Can I give you an example of that? So you and I might have talked back during when I was running for president. One of the things, I had a lot of plans I wanted to do, but you may remember I paid for every one of those plans. And one of the things I talked about as a pay for was a 15% corporate minimum tax on these giant corporations. Amazon was reported $11 billion in profits on their book profits and then turned around and paid zero in taxes. They pay less than Patty's Bar and Grill, right? This is wrong, right? Wrong. So I said 15% corporate minimum tax. I cannot tell you the number of people who said to me, oh, get real here, Senator. Nobody is going to go for that. That is so far out. And yet, you keep talking about it, you keep fighting for it, you show it to a bunch of people. I showed it to Angus King, among others. Angus said, you know, that makes real sense to me. Angus and I start talking to more people in the Senate. And then last summer, when the negotiations were occurring for what became the Inflation Reduction Act, there was the part over pharmaceuticals. There's that huge part, our biggest effort ever on climate change initiatives, about $350 billion, paid for 100% by a 15% corporate minimum tax. That moved from something nobody could even envision to the center of the Democratic Party. We all voted for it, made it happen.
Talking to Elizabeth Warren.
You know, speaking of your having run for president, should Joe Biden run again for president? He'll be 86 by the time his second term is over.
He should run again.
Why?
And he is running again because he has gotten a tremendous amount done. It's been 2 years. He's had the skinniest possible majority in the United States Senate and only a very small majority in the House. And yet, look at what we've done. I'll pick one that I just love. Besides the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the first time we've raised corporate taxes in 30 years, we also got the biggest climate package we've ever gotten. It goes into effect right now, the $35 cap for seniors on insulin. Think about these things. Seniors are not going to have to spend more than $2,000 a year on prescription drugs. But look at the other, the CHIPS. This is how I love to say this bill, the CHIPS and Science bill. This, when I ran for Senate a decade ago, I said one of the things I think we need to do as a nation, we need to double our investment in science. That is exactly what we did last summer, and Joe Biden signed that into law. He showed he's willing to wade into the fights. He waded into the fight on student loan debt for 43 million Americans.
If he's that old in his second term, the vice presidency becomes even more important. Should Kamala Harris be his choice the second time around?
You know, I really want to defer to what makes Biden comfortable on his team. I've known Kamala for a long time. I like Kamala. I knew her back when she was an attorney general and I was still teaching, and we worked on the housing crisis together. So we go way back, but they have to be a team, and my sense is they are. I don't mean that by suggesting I think there are any problems. I think they are.
Before you go, speaking of wading in, you waded in a couple of days ago in the Democratic primary to replace Dianne Feinstein, Katie Porter. And there is a Democrat, the only Democrat, as far as I know, who announced that he is running for the United States Senate seat in Arizona. Now that Kyrsten Sinema is an independent. Will you support the Democrat?
It's early now to be talking about what we're going to do in that race. Kyrsten Sinema hadn't even said whether or not she's running. So I think we need to let that one play out a little bit more. I do want to say about
Kate, but would you ever imagine endorsing an independent over a Democratic nominee?
You'd have to explain to me the circumstances that would make that happen.
Okay.
I want to say, though, about Katie Porter. I've known Katie Porter for over 20 years now. She was my student. I can describe her first day in class. Oh, man. There are a lot of stories I can tell you about Katie. But she also ended up working on my bankruptcy project ultimately. Eventually, she became, as you know, a law professor herself, wrote books in bankruptcy, did a lot of the studies. She's someone who fights from the heart. And she came to me in 2016 after Donald Trump was elected. And she said, I can't do this. I can't sit on side and just keep writing the articles. And she said, I'm going to run for Congress. And I said, from where? And she said, well, Orange County. And I said, I don't know California politics, Katie, but haven't they, like, voted Republican since, you know, the earth was created or something? And Katie said, yeah, I'm running in a district that literally has never elected a Democrat. And I said, so what's your plan? And she said, because that's always my question, she started ticking off the things that matter to people. And she said, I'll fight this fight. She said, will you, if you'll fight alongside me? And I said, count me in. And by golly, she's won 3 times in a row in a red district by fighting for the things she believes in. And to me, that's the kind of thing we gotta stay behind. We gotta support that.
So
KatiePorter.com, you can send her $5. Okay.
Sorry we didn't see you at the library. We'll make it up to you next time. Yeah. And to people who were there to see you today, Senator Warren. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
it's
thank you very much
be
for being here.
Guys.
Much appreciate you taking the time to be with us. We've been speaking with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. After a quick break, we're going to open the lines and talk with you about something we talked to the senator about, the meager state of child care in America. What are your experiences? Are you spending more than your mortgage to go to daycare? If you can even find a daycare, are you staying home because daycare exceeds what you can afford to pay for it? 877-301-8970 is the number. You can call us or text us at that number. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie and I are eating rapidly. We had a run back from the library, and so I rudely had something in my mouth. But I don't anymore.
You're all right?
We're not at the Boston Public Library today, and we apologize. There were some technical screw-ups. We will be back Tuesday again. Ask the Governor, our first of monthly Ask the Governors, with a new governor, 12 to 1. Ask the Mayor with Mayor Wu, a special time, 1:30 to 2:30. That's right. Our show ordinarily ends at 2. It'll end 2:30 then. Until the end of the hour, we're taking a couple of minutes to check in with you on the state of child care in Massachusetts. Since the start of the pandemic, Massachusetts has lost, this is incredible, lost more than 500 daycare centers and home-based daycares, a reduction of nearly 2,300 licensed slots for kids. It's according to the Boston Globe. Another 700 could close if funding cleared during the pandemic is allowed to expire, and it's expected to, or at least it's scheduled to, in the spring. We want to know how you've been affected by the hits that child care facilities have taken over the past few years, the unaffordability that Elizabeth Warren was talking about a couple of minutes ago. How much harder has it made parenting? How has it affected your life? Have you figured a way to work the system so you could get semi-affordable child care? And if you're a child care worker, who Senator Warren was also talking about, how are you making it through? As she said, you can make more money working at the local gas station. Should leaders like Warren and her congressional colleagues be doing more to fight for things like that 7% cap on families' income that could be spent on child care? We want to know how you're weathering this unaffordable nightmare that has been with us for far too long. 877-301-8970. You can text or you can call.
You know, our GBH colleague, Craig Lamont, did a story about the state of child care in this new report that came out from the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation. 16,000 kids are on a waiting list for a state child care subsidy. Inadequate child care access costs the state almost $3 billion in lost earnings, and it cost employers $812 million. And it also talks about the fact that even if you can afford to pay for child care, you can't find it because places are shutting down because they can't keep workers there. The Globe did a piece, Katie Johnson did it, about a place up in Tewksbury that had been operating for 20 years. People called it this magical place. Kids could run through fields, walk in the woods, picnic with horses up there in Tewksbury. And the place had to close its doors because not just COVID, but they were just overwhelmed by costs and no money and chronic staffing shortages. As the senator said, you can make more money pumping gas or working at Starbucks. And it's just made it impossible. And I know people that are paying $2,000 a month, $2,500 a month. Who can afford that kind
mortgage
of money?
Payments, essentially.
They are, yeah, or more than a mortgage payment.
One other thing from Craig Lamont's story that bears mentioning, I mean, occasionally when I mention relentlessly the five-month hiatus the legislature took, and people think I'm trying to be funny or something, in Craig's report he mentions the state Senate last year passed a sweeping reform bill focused on the helping the state's child care industry. You know what happened in the House? Didn't pass in
yeah,
the
it
House.
Didn't pass.
And then the House went on a five-month
yeah,
recess.
What is the excuse
now,
from
and,
that?
I don't know. But, and by the way, the legislature did do something, did put some money into the system. But there was an opportunity for serious reform. And if I remember correctly, modeled to some degree, at least on the approach that Elizabeth Warren was suggesting, but obviously it couldn't get done in time because they had to take a five-month break to do whatever it is, run for re-election or some such thing. But we're not going to I don't know why I even did this. We're not going to savage elected officials. We want to know about what your personal circumstances are, how you're dealing with the crisis, how you're dealing with the unaffordability, and how is it affecting your life. 877-301-8970 is our number.
I don't know if your texts are working, Jim, mine or not.
Oh,
so, okay,
I'll
you have to look in the
right
text
now.
And see
okay.
if they're working because we have a technical difficulty.
Well, why should they work? I mean, by the way, can I say something about that? Because I feel bad every time we say about a technical. We have among the best tech workers like ever, and things work 99% of the time beautifully. Occasionally, things fall apart, and today they did at the last minute. So our apologies to all of you, particularly those of you who are already at the library to see Elizabeth Warren earlier this morning. 877-301-8970.
The Pew Research Center was talking about, too, about the breakdown in child care between mothers and fathers. And fathers naturally, of course, think that they're doing just as much as the mothers, and the mothers pointedly express that that's not quite their experience. But they're talking about the tremendous pressure now because most people have to work, right? The two families, two career families are the norm in many parts of this country. So there's no wife at home anymore to do all these things, like take care of the kids or like do the cooking and all that kind of stuff.
But that is one of the reasons why hybrid work has become as popular as it did during the pandemic, not only because people like not doing the commute and everything else that comes with going to work every day, but it provided an opportunity, even though it was a burdensome opportunity, for someone to stay home and work from home at the same time that they were taking care of a kid. The number is 877-301-8970 is the number.
And one last thing before we take the calls. And are your texts working yet? Because mine
I don't know. I'll look in a second.
Oh, we're having something. Aiden is here to fix the texting. We have reviewed it many times. It's still not working. Anyway, the deal is that this is causing tremendous stress for families. Even if you can work part of the time at home and that saves you child care money, it is very difficult to get a job done with 3 and 4 year olds running around. Living room while you're trying to get work done on the phone.
Okay.
My texts are working.
The texts are working now. Thank you very much. We're getting up to speed little by little. Where are we going on the phones? Anywhere yet? Or we're still working on that?
We're going
too?
To Judy and Belmont.
No, we are. Judy and Belmont. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a grandparent.
Yep.
And I heavily subsidize my grandkids' very, very good quality daycare.
Uh-huh.
And I'm actually driving now to pick up one of my grandkids who's sick. So, you know, my daughter is very lucky to have me, but I'm a retired DCF supervisor as well, and I have seen firsthand what poor quality daycare is. So, you know, to me, I'm happy to help subsidize my daughter's daycare, but it is extremely expensive. And she and her husband are public school teachers who would never be able to afford the daycare that my grandkids go to.
Well, and it sounds like you appreciate the fact, Judy, that while your kid are lucky to have you around and able to help, that the vast majority of people are not in that situation. Their parent cannot do what they, in fact, can't afford to do. And so they're lucky to have you, but luck is not, as you know, going to fix the problem. But good for you, Judy. Hope the grandkid's okay. Thank you for the call. 877-301-8970.
So many situations I know of, the grandparents are stepping in, they're taking care of the kid one day a week or 2 days a week because their children can't afford child care for their grandchildren. Listen to this. My husband and I both have good jobs. We were lucky enough to find wonderful child care for our twins, but it cost us $44,000 per year for 3 years. Half of that came straight out of the savings we would have used for a down payment on a house. You know, I want to know why there's such resentment about this.
Resentment about what?
About child care. Why there's this attitude, which I think is fairly prevalent. Sweetheart, you had the baby. Shut up. You should have thought of this before you had the baby. This idea that in other countries, in all in European countries, needless to say, Scandinavian countries, which have great safety nets, but Germany has a great economy, and Germany manages to supply child care to these kids. So what is it about the United States?
France, in the Michael Moore movie, a nurse or whatever it is comes out to the house to do a little training for a first-time parent kind of thing. Well, it's like almost every – I mean, this is what Senator Warren was talking about. I mean, almost every family support thing that the rest of the world considers critical, we consider too radical.
Right, like a decent maternity leave or like a child care help. And it's to me – the public school system should start at the age of two, and the kids can go to school at the age of two. It'll be preschool, obviously, for two-year-olds, but I think you get the point. Here's John and Ashland. He said, we got a foster kid placed with us through DCF a few weeks ago. They found his daycare and are paying for it. No idea how biological parents do it without the support we have through the state. Put my taxes in kids' education, health care, and cut the military, says a foster parent. And John, you're a saint, because it's not easy being a foster parent. He says, we have the money, but not the will to do the right
thing.
Wait
to hear this one.
What?
I became a child care center director in order to be able to afford to have a child. No lie. I had one child, changed my profession once he went to school. It's insane, and the pay is terrible despite the regulations that must be followed. Corporate child care, KinderCare, which was owned by Michael Milken of Junk Bond fame, that is Kim in Norton, who became a child care center director so she could afford to have her kid and or his kid in child care.
And by the way, you know, we always talk about calling your legislators about things, and when they get 10 phone calls, it's a tsunami, and they actually think maybe they should do something. Since the House didn't get around to passing this bit of legislation that the Senate passed, maybe it's an opportunity for people to call their legislators in the House at 617-722-2000 and tell them they would like to have the state do something more about this. Listen to this one. The cost of preschool is outrageous in this country. Quality not great. I was fortunate enough to be able to send both my sons for 1 year to preschool in Germany, which I just mentioned, where we lived for that year. You cannot believe the quality, the professionalism of the staff. They have a cook and a vegetarian menu as well. They have a cleaning lady that comes in every day, and they take their shoes off. They put house shoes on. It's a beautiful facility. They go on hikes. They do gardening, cooking, even though they brush their teeth after meals, and it costs, guess how much it costs?
I see. It's unbelievable.
$100 a month.
Yeah, it's a different world. 877-301-8970. We're talking about child care travails here on Boston Public Radio.
Yeah, what are you doing about it? Can you afford it? Do you have to quit your job to afford it? Are you getting your in-laws or your parents to come in and help you with the kids? How are you managing to raise your children and hold on to a job? The number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Senator Elizabeth Warren was here in our studio in Brighton with us a few minutes ago. We're in Brighton on a, what day is today, Friday?
Mm-hmm.
Because we had a little bit of a technical crash at the library. We apologize to people who came, particularly those who came early to see Senator Warren. We will be back there on Tuesday. We're talking about the unaffordability of child care, your personal experiences, and what we need to do about it. Here's a pretty good one, Marjorie, a text. We value our children as our most important resource, but we treat the people who care for them like they are worthless. Poor pay, abusive parents, no respect for teachers and daycare workers. No wonder they're leaving, and this is not going to change until we start treating them like the national resource they are. What was the statistic I used in the opening here? That since the beginning of the pandemic, 500 daycare centers and home-based daycares have closed. Another 700 will close. I think in the 700, there's something like 16,000 slots or some such thing will close if the subsidy that the government was providing is allowed to expire in the spring, which is when it's scheduled to expire. So not only is it not getting better, it's getting worse. And I thought it was really interesting what you said to Senator Warren about it's essentially no better since she had kids, since you had kids.
Which
was a long time ago.
Rachel in Harvard, thank you for calling.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
Hey.
Yeah, so the cost was so high. I saved up before we had a kid, and I wound up being so old that we could only have one.
Oh, oh God, Rachel.
Is that true, or are you trying to make a point? Is that true?
No, it's true. But the other thing I was going to say is that the time of day, I'm wondering if you're getting parents who, you know, have the kids in daycare right now.
And yeah, they're probably at work. You mean they can't call us and complain about their situation because they're at work and they can't call?
I happen to be listening to you guys in the car. But yeah. I'm glad you're covering the topic. It's a really important topic.
So, Rachel,
it's out of control.
Before you go, what are your fellow moms? I mean, I'm sure you talked to a lot of other moms who are in similar situations. Even they may not be just with the one kid because you waited a long time. But what do people say? Are they feel like they got to do something with their legislators, or are they just getting their in-laws to help them out, or what's their deal?
Yeah, I don't think they're thinking about their legislators. I mean, you know, my neighbor here who was in a waiting list for 9 months to get her kid, you know, was working. Thank goodness she was able to work from home, so she was able to get her kid, you know, have her kid work. Well, she was taking care of a newborn while working from home.
Rachel, we're glad you called. I'm sorry you had to wait, but glad you got one. You wanted anyway. Here
Listen
is Maureen from Londonderry. Is that what you're going to read?
No, I was going to read Kim and Norton.
You do. I read it already.
Oh, you did?
This is Maureen from Londonderry, New Hampshire. In 1988, I left a good full-time job to work part-time to care for my child. It will seriously affect my retirement. My daughter had same choices for her children. I urged her to keep her full-time job for her kids and her own health and security. So the impact, I mean, the point that's made there, which is quite obvious but important, is not only does it affect you when you're paying the bills, it affects you later in life because so many people, particularly women, have to leave the workforce at least part-time because they can't afford full-time child care.
Did you read about the couple that have the kids with the grandparents? They
no.
don't see the children?
No.
Listen to this. My wife and I both have careers. My wife is a nurse. We have a six-month-old. Her grandparents need to watch her for 4 to 5 nights a week, and they live 60 miles away. It's the only way we can afford to do it.
Great.
But we're not able to see our daughter during the week when they're working.
That's great.
I mean, wow.
I'd say so.
Wow. And this, here's another one. I paid $17,000 last year to send twins to daycare 2 days a week. 2 days a week. Right now, I'm paying $300 a week. I work from home 2 days a week now, and my mother-in-law watches the kids the third day, and I have one in kindergarten. It's near impossible to keep up with the costs. They also go through staff at the daycare like crazy. That's another thing. It's really difficult for these kids. You know, little babies have attachment issues. A lot of little babies don't like daycare that much. To have the teachers keep changing, mm-hmm. it's very upsetting to these kids. That's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is the money. But, you know, that's a big problem. Allison in Reading, thank you for calling.
Hello, Allison.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for talking to me.
I am
a licensed family child care provider.
Oh, great.
In Reading. And one of the things I've been screaming from the rooftops for the past 20 years that I've been a licensed family child care provider is that our ratios are too low. The state of Massachusetts caps all family child care at 10 children. No matter how big your home is, no matter how many staff people you have, it's 10. All the other New England states allow for at least 12 or up to 16 in some cases, depending on the ages of the children. Now, of course, supply and demand is what causes prices to go up. If there's not enough childcare spots, you're going to pay more for it. And the other issue is not being able to pay staff members enough to keep them or to get good quality staff members. So if the state would just increase our ratios to even 12, the licensing doesn't really make any sense. If you're by yourself in a family child care home, you can have 6 children. If you add a second staff, you only get 10 children max. The numbers aren't making sense, and it's a one-size-fits-all number. It doesn't matter how big your space is, how much education you have. I have a staff member right now with a master's degree in early childhood education. And I have a bachelor's degree. We're still at 10 kids max. And I have a huge
And it
space.
Doesn't matter space. If they're 4- and 5-year-olds or infants. It's all one size fits all, no matter the age of the kids.
Age of the kids, in family daycare in Massachusetts, the maximum you can have is 10, period. There is no exception.
You know, Allison, I seem to recall, and you would know more than I, that part of the reason this happened is because of years ago, bad things happened, and the consensus was there were too many kids in the place. Isn't that why
we have these? She's saying that other states have higher thresholds.
Yeah, I know that. But isn't that what happened here? Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't there?
There was actually a situation in Reading where a woman had way too many children. She was not licensed.
Yeah.
I mean, if the state could make it not a one-size-fits-all policy.
Yeah.
If we could look at each individual daycare
provider, that's very good point.
You have this much space, you can have this many staff people. All right, we're going to allow you to have 12 children or 13 or 14. You know, centers are run that way. If you have a Bright Horizons, you're not max. There's no limit. It's based on square footage and staff.
Yeah.
So family child care is the most affordable child care in the state.
Allison,
and if we could have more kids, we could be even more affordable.
You made your case really powerfully. Thank you for doing it, and thanks for doing it here. Sarah from Webster, I used to work for DCF. I would spend hours on the phone calling dozens of daycares to no avail because no one has openings. Parents are desperate. They want more for their kids, can't find childcare, can't afford it. Then being called deadbeat by society if they stay home. The stigma is ridiculous. I'm glad my kids are grown. When you were talking to, was it Allison a minute ago?
Yes.
I was scanning scores of texts.
Yeah.
There's not one single text that I could find that had a positive story about their experience.
You know,
by the way, they're not. I don't mean positive, meaning they weren't fond of the quality of care, but on the affordability issue, not one single text saying they made it work.
You know what's funny about the United States, too? I mean, Elizabeth Warren ran for president. One of her big things was you were not going to pay more than 7% of your income for child care, which I thought was a huge game changer, and I thought it would matter. And Biden has adopted some of her ideas, not that one. But it's almost as if we don't even know these things. It's almost as if people vote for people without being aware of what they stand for. I mean, that would have changed lives.
Well, Marjorie, you know what we didn't talk about with Senator Warren is this was not a child care thing, but indirectly it was, because money is money. You spend it where you spend it. The child tax credit. The child tax credit was expanded, as you remember, early in Biden's term. It only reduced the poverty rate by 50%.
Yeah.
So what do they do? Because Joe Manchin didn't like it. I can't remember if Kyrsten Sinema didn't like it. They couldn't get the votes, and the thing died. Something that not only helped families, and as I say, Republican and Democratic families and independent families, but was proven to allow people to rise out of poverty. And you know what happens when people rise out of poverty beyond having better lives? Government ends up spending less money on them down the line.
But you know what's weird?
Yet because they are anti-anything.
But you talk about protests. Was there even a peep about that? It's almost like we don't know what's going on. And if something goes on and it affects us, we don't do anything about it. I mean, part of it, I think, is our problem. You always talk about how, you know, they're trying to take 6 months off the retirement age in France and 20,000 people are in the streets. And here
much
we have
more than 20,000 people.
Okay, whatever it was. And here we are in the United States where people had this opportunity to not be broke. And the studies show, what do they spend the money on? Food, housing, clothing, necessities. It wasn't going to the casinos and gambling and stuff like that. And no one really got upset about it.
In 1988, these are incredible. My daughter's daycare was twice my mortgage. I was in school and actually some typos. I can't read the rest. That's Lillian in the car. Daycare was the singular reason we only had one kid, just like the caller. And we threw a party when she started kindergarten. That's Jason in Plymouth.
Oh, yeah. No, my date childcare was more than my mortgage when my kids were young. Ben from New Hampshire says the cost of childcare is high. When the pandemic happened, my wife and I pulled our kids from daycare. I, the dad, took 100% of child rearing. I am self-employed, so it made sense. We have twins and now a 7-year-old. After running what felt like a house daycare for 2 years, I no longer feel childcare costs are too high. Completely worth the cost, in my opinion. Anyway, it's a mess. I think it's fair to say it's a big mess.
Thanks for your calls and your texts.
Okay.
By the way, I wish we could publish all these texts. They are incredible.
Yep. Well, we're moving on. And after the news, we're going to be joined by Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. We're going to talk about the case of the five Memphis police officers who's been charged with a murder for beating to death a 20-year-old man who was stopped for reckless driving. We're also going to talk to her about the Supreme Court basically getting away with not having to answer any serious questions about the leak of the opinion of the Dobbs decision. The fact that they were treated differently. The justices were treated differently than any other person in our government would be, it seems to me anyway. And we'll see what Nancy Gertner thinks about it. Federal Judge Nancy Gertner, retired Federal Judge Nancy Gertner, is next. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Crossley joins us to discuss former President Trump's racist taunts of Elaine Chao and her response, unlike the silence of her husband, Mitch McConnell. Then media maven Sue O'Connell discusses Facebook allowing Trump back on its platform and George Santos's latest drag queen battle.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Victoria Kitchuk is a chocolate sommelier and owner of Coco Beantown, a chocolate tour and tasting company. She'll join us for a tasting of some luxury chocolate brands based in Massachusetts ahead of the Chocolate Expo this weekend in Wilmington. All that ahead on Boston.
8 degrees in Boston. I'm Henry Santoro. This is GBH News.
I think Henry forgot who he was there for a second, did he?
I don't know. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eek, and you're listening to hour number 2 of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We apologize. We were supposed to be at the library today, but we had technical difficulties, so we are not there. If you're looking for us, we're here in Brighton.
But if you're looking for us on Tuesday, we will be at the library. Ask the new governor, first of her monthly appearances, more healing, noon to 1. Ask the mayor, Michelle Wu, 1:30 to 2:30. I know that sounds odd. We're usually done at 2, but it will be 1:30 to 2:30, both on Tuesday. We're joined now on Zoom for another edition of On the Docket by retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's also a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and a BPR contributor. Hello, Judge Gertner.
Hello.
Thank you very much, Judge Gertner, for joining us. So I wanted to start out with the five officers down in Memphis who have been charged with murder, all five of them varying degrees, for the alleged beating death of Tyree Nichols. He was a 29-year-old black man who was stopped for a traffic, for reckless driving. The police officers were all black as well. I can't recall cops getting arrested so fast after any and charged after any kind of case like this ever. So I wonder what you make of this whole thing.
Well, it's usually the issue with a police officer with violence allegedly done by a police officer is whether the violence was reasonable under the circumstances or whether it was excessive. What is interesting about this case and really troubling is that these charges were accompanied by a kidnapping charge. that meant that a grand jury and the prosecutor believed that there was no basis for the stop at all. In other words, there was no evidence of reckless driving. There was no basis for the stop at all. That's the only reason for a kidnapping, is a taking without authority. So the usual kind of debate about it was legitimate to stop the guy, you know, the suspect, you know, acted in a way that caused the police or engendered violence on their part that may be excessive. All the nuances are gone if there was no basis to stop at all from the get-go.
And I think the police chief there, this C.J. Davis, she did not waste any time reaching conclusions, and I think she did the right thing. Here she is discussing the body cam footage that I think most of you know will be released. I think it's 6 o'clock Central Time today, 7 o'clock our time. Here's Chief Davis.
This incident was heinous, reckless, and inhumane. And in the vein of transparency, when the video is released in the coming days, you will see this for yourselves. I expect you to feel what the Nichols family feels. I expect you to feel outrage in the disregard of basic human rights, as our police officers have taken an oath to do the opposite of what transpired on the video.
I want to be clear again. When she says in a few days, that was what she said a couple of days ago. It is being released tonight at 6 o'clock Central.
You know, Judge Gertner, often in these horrible police brutality cases, we're talking about white police officers attacking a black man. This is 5 police officers attacking a black man. So where does race figure into this?
Well, I have 2 answers to that. I mean, one is what it says is something about the training that these particular police officers got. This was a special unit. And that had a special charge to, you know, that was not, they were not being, they were to be proactive. They were not to be responsive to calls. They were supposed to be a sort of a stop violence unit. And so there's an interesting question about the responsibility, the duties of this kind of unit, and whether or not that this kind of unit can operate without controls. And so apparently the controls were not here, the kind of supervision. The black-white issue the issue may be more about the way these officers were trained and the, you know, the warrior cop mentality than it is a black or white.
Except for the victim.
The egregiousness of this may have trumped any racial issues.
Except the victim was black. I can't help but wonder if this would have happened to a white man.
I thought you meant the reverse. I thought you were saying they were so quick to move against the cops because the cops were black, well, as opposed to most settings where the cops in these incidents are white.
I think there's 2 things. Yeah. It's the reason they did move so fast, as Jim just said, because they were black cops. And also the fact that the victim was black. I do wonder if this would have happened to a white man.
I mean, there are lots of layers to this. So would it have happened to a white man? We've seen officers who sort of focus on, quote, high crime areas, who make presumptions about young black men. So that is one issue where they have, I hate to put it this way, sort of pulled the trigger, done what they did. If the person who was stopped was white, that's one issue. And then the question is whether these charges would have been brought as quickly against white officers. Again, maybe not in a case in which there was nuance. We don't know this yet, but it doesn't appear from the reaction, the incredible reaction of all the officers, you know, of the chief of police, that there may have been absolutely no nuance here, no basis for it. And so that even if the officers had been white, there still would have been the same reaction. We'll know that when we see the tape this evening.
You know, speaking of potential double standards, well, this is not a potential double standard. This is a double standard. The Supreme Court announced that they completed the inquiry into who leaked the Dobbs decision, the decision to overrule Roe v. Wade, and their conclusion was we have no idea who did it. They applied a certain level of scrutiny to people who worked for the Supreme Court, and in their initial report, didn't even say if they had questioned justices. They issued a second, a supplemental a supplement the next day saying, yeah, we did talk to justices. It was a really good back and forth. It turns out that they didn't make them sign affidavits like they made everybody else. Oh, and by the way, we're not going to tell you whether we spoke to any of their spouses. What was your takeaway from this, quote, investigation, Judge Gertner?
That it was a, quote, investigation, end quote. I mean, I think, you know, at a time when we have extraordinary forensic tools at our disposal, the notion that this suffices for an investigation is extraordinary. And it says something. I mean, the broader issue here is that the Supreme Court sort of walks away from troubling situations without the same kind of ethical enforcement of ethical rules that anybody else has. I can't imagine if this happened anywhere else. If we leaked secrets, industrial secrets, that you would get to the point where you'd only go to the line people, and then when it got up to the CEO, you say, "Hey, did you do it?" And he says, "No." I say, "Okay, I'm good." I can't imagine that would happen anywhere else.
And by the way, we want the phone of every clerk, but we don't ask for the phones of the justices, right?
Yeah. Right. Well, the other thing that I found so crazy about this is the person that was in charge of this, the marshal, who's
Curly.
Curly, who's best known for saying oyez, oyez, oyez as the justices enter the court or whatever it is they say.
Yeah, you make it sound like oy, oy, oy.
Yeah.
That's exactly what she wanted it to sound
oye,
like.
Oyez.
Whatever it is, I mean, that's her major job, and that she was in charge of this is upsetting. And then the fact that
Why do you think that was, Marjorie?
Well, because they didn't want to do a serious
investigation. So that Roberts, the Chief Justice, could control
right.
what the investigator does and doesn't do with his justices.
Let me sort of be judge here to some degree. I mean, it certainly is a question of some delicacy when you're investigating judges, right? I mean, there are lines that you don't want to cross usually when you're investigating judges. There's separation of powers issues. And so they want to have someone inside the Supreme Court rather than an outside entity, rather than someone from the executive.
Yeah, but Judge Gertner, with all due respect, as someone who has to work with these people every day, and so the ability of that woman to what I think all three of us would believe was a thorough investigation was inhibited before it even began.
Well, no, that's true. In other words, it's not a sort of off-on switch that either you have, Garland investigate or you have someone who sees you every day and has a relationship with you every day. Right. There would have been something in between. I believe you should check on this, that I saw a news flash that the expert that had been hired by the Supreme Court had financial ties to the justices.
That's great.
Oh, God.
That's great.
Yeah, I mean, someone has to check that. I just saw that for a second. But again, the larger issue here, we saw this on the White House Commission on the Supreme Court, the question of the enforcement of ethical rules against the Supreme Court, raises, I mean, they say they're bound by the usual ethical rules, but the fact of the matter is there's no mechanism to enforce it. And this is a classic example of that.
Oh, this is Michael Chertoff you're talking about. That's exactly right. That former head of Homeland Security. Here's CNN. Supreme Court did not disclose financial relationship with expert brought in to review leak probe. And what Chertoff did, he was the first head of Homeland Security. He's the one who said, oh, the job that Curly did was a really good job. That's essentially what his role was. And he has financial ties to the – I mean, this is
– There were a bunch of interesting things I found in these stories about the Supreme Court this week. One I didn't know about, it's a big deal to be a clerk for a Supreme Court justice in terms of your law career. I didn't realize that you could – get as much of a $450,000 signing bonus if you're coming from being a justice's clerk to a law firm. So that really raises the question of how much the clerks might have been screwing themselves by being too honest about the justices who might get annoyed with them,
right?
And then they wouldn't get their $450,000 signing bonus.
No, there's no question. I mean, but there's a financial incentive for them to be discreet. There's also an ethical incentive for them to be discreet. And the question is, what kind of procedure should you have that would enable you to break through those walls? And this investigation was not the way to do it.
Well, I think where you were going a minute ago, and if I'm just repeating what you said, my apologies. We've talked to you about 3,000 times about there's nobody that no body, not nobody, no body that has the ability to oversee the ethical standards or lack of ethical standards. For example, right. Clarence Thomas and Jenny Thomas, as we've talked about ad nauseum with you and others. But this notion that I think was, as you said, was one of the things that was discussed in this presidential commission.
Right.
Yeah, that you, Larry Tribe, and a bunch of 28 other people or something served on Biden's commission on the Supreme Court. That if that thing of either former justices or state chief just something had been formed, it not only could oversee ethical, alleged ethical breaches or at least ethical questions, but also lead this investigation. So, and they would not be as compromised, clearly, even if they had personal relationships with justices.
Right. I mean, there's no, because we can't say enough how extraordinarily powerful our Supreme Court is. Not just in terms of life tenure and the usual issues that people talk about, but there is no watchdog, no ethical watchdog who would basically enforce the rules. They say they're bound by it. We trust them to be bound by it. But recent events suggest that we shouldn't. And this is a classic example of that. So there's just no body. And so and I think that part of it is this sort of air of impunity. I can't describe it any other way. They are not accountable to anyone, and they act as if they're not accountable to anyone. I wrote a piece in the New York Times with Judith Resnick a few weeks ago about the chief judge's end of the year state of the court, and it was pablum in an incredibly.
Wait, your op-ed was pablum, or their end of the year?
No. My op-ed was fabulous.
Fabulous.
No, but his report was sort of no there there. First, he cites the incredibly courageous judges who enforced Brown versus Board of Education, right? A decision that they are poised to undermine in the affirmative action cases. Just on the chutzpah to use that as the centerpiece of this report, but then attached to the report was also pages and pages, which shows that the docket of the Supreme Court of all the federal courts have dramatically declined. There are lots of reasons for that, but certainly one reason is civil rights. Any civil rights lawyer worth his salt or her salt will not go into federal court if there's any possibility of a review to the Supreme Court. So essentially, they've created the conditions to minimize their own docket. And this wasn't worthy of mention in his report.
You know, one last thing about the Supreme Court for me anyway, Stephen Mazie had a piece in The Atlantic talking about how the justices seem to have contempt for each other in a way we haven't seen since some members of FDR's court way back in the 1940s, talking about how, you know, Justice Alito, the who wrote the Dobbs decision, is kind of making these weird jokes to Elena Kagan about whether or not she knows the Ashley Madison dating site. That's about married couples looking for affairs. It talks about the hostility between, I guess, Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett get along very well. They're both very conservative. But there's a lot of animosity between, like, Sotomayor and Justice Thomas. And they also talked about the seating chart on the court, where the liberals, like Sotomayor, flanked by Thomas and Gorsuch, and Kagan's flanked by Alito and Brett Kavanaugh, and then the new Justice Jackson is stuck down at the end of the bench next to Kavanaugh. It reminded
because of seniority, which is how they're seated.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
But it just kind of painted a picture of people being hostile toward each other, next to each other. It was kind of like sad, because it was almost like, to me, a mirror of the country that we're not opposite in our political ideas. We're bad people. You know, we're like bad people, not just wrong, but kind of evil. And it seems like that's seeping into the Supreme Court to me.
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things that we have seen in the Trump years, others have said it, I'm not new in this, you know, is that Trump began to say the quiet part out loud.
Yeah.
And in the Supreme Court's decisions of the past, you know, of the past few years, they have been saying the quiet part out loud. There's a level of vitriol in these decisions that you are not used to seeing in Supreme Court decisions. You certainly didn't see it when Scalia and Ginsburg were alive, even though they were, you know, as opposite as one can imagine. But so then now it's spilled over into oral argument as well. And that's very troubling, because if you see the Supreme Court as an impregnable box that nothing can get into, if they're not getting along, I mean, that's very troubling. Then you begin to see things like someone leaking the decision. I mean, think about what would the incentive was to leak the Dobbs decision. And that's what people have speculated about. But one part of the speculation was to make sure that the right held, that no one was going, that Roberts's efforts to try to you know, dilute that decision wasn't successful. That was one theory.
But there's, you know, also a theory that a liberal leaked it in the hopes that there'd be such outrage about the outright repeal of Roe that Alito et al. Might back off before the formal decision was released.
Right. That could well be. I mean, but the notion was that it was done for a purpose.
Yeah.
It was,
right,
not
exactly.
It's not a whoops. And it, you're right. It could have been either the right saying, shoring up the backbone of the justices who may have been wavering, one justice who was wavering, and shoring up, or alternatively creating a firestorm on the other side. I don't know. But that's sort of, that really was a breach of trust of extraordinary proportions. And then I can imagine the rage that other justices felt that that was leaked.
You know, Nancy Gertner, I wanted to ask you about one, well, it's not a small element, one element of a couple of cases that have grabbed the attention of virtually everybody in this region. I think most people know that Adam Montgomery, I think it was yesterday, was indicted on second-degree murder in his daughter Harmony's death. Everybody in this country was following the disappearance of Anna Walsh and her husband being charged with having murdered her. There's not a body in either case. If you're a sentencing judge, like you once, well, a judge who sentences people at the end of a trial, if there's a conviction, or at any stage in the proceeding, if a defendant agrees to direct authorities to a body, which I assume is horrible as the outcome is, at least it provides some sort of something to people who have suffered this incredible loss. Does a judge look more kindly in terms of sentencing on the perpetrator in these cases because they did that? Or is, you know what I mean? Is that a factor
exactly
in sentencing? Okay.
Yeah, what's the answer? Exactly. I mean, if the defendant charged with these horrible crimes says, go easy on me and I'll tell you where the bodies are so you can have a proper burial, would that figure into the decision? And I think it's, you know, sort of part of the pot of things that might be considered. But the more difficult question would be if they say to the prosecutor, will you charge less? Will you recommend less if we give you access to the body? And the prosecutor, then that becomes the basis of a plea bargain for a lesser charge.
How do you feel about that? When you were a judge, how do you feel about those circumstances when those discussions were going on?
You know, I mean, I don't have a way to feel about it. I can't say concretely, right? Because I think it depends on the nature of the crime.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in the allegation that he carved up his wife's body and, you know, dumped it in different places, seems you have to go a long way to say that telling me where the pieces are is going to somehow mitigate your crime. If the underlying crime was a crime of passion or provocation, that might be a different issue. But a premeditated, totally crazy crime like this, that's in a different category. But the missing body, I mean, people don't, you know, you see this from television and it's true, which is the body itself is evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The absence of the evidence that you glean from the body makes a big difference.
We're talking to retired Judge Nancy Gertner from Harvard Law School. Somebody over at Harvard, I'm not sure who it was, interviewed you about Alec Baldwin, who's facing involuntary manslaughter charges for the gun that went off in the while they were he was producing and acting in that Rust, that movie. I guess it's still going to be made, and ended up killing a cinematographer. You were asked whether it's fair to use the criminal justice system as opposed to the civil court to assess his responsibility in that case. What'd you say?
Well, the criminal justice system, you can't bring charges unless the line between what was legal and illegal was clear to you, right? You don't bring charges to create new law or new responsibilities, and that was what's going on here, at least from the reporting. Baldwin was not responsible for determining whether or not the gun was a live gun or not. Now, apparently the district attorney found some people who said, well, I usually check it or I always check it. But the issue is, what was the standard of mm-hmm. care? What was known to people? What was known to him as to what his responsibilities were? And maybe it should be part of his responsibilities. Maybe the law is wrong, in which case you change the law. You don't bring a criminal case for someone who could not possibly have known that that was within his realm of responsibilities. That's the problem here. Some people say that because he was the producer, he had responsibilities. But again, there's a question about whether the producer had the obligation, to micromanage in that way. I contrasted Baldwin's case with the Station nightclub fire
yes.
in Rhode Island. There, the owners were indicted and pled guilty, as well as the head of the band, I believe. And that's a different situation. The owner's responsibility to secure a safe place to make sure that fire safety rules were observed was clear. That's not the case here with an actor. And you don't use the criminal justice system. You don't use liberty for the purpose of setting new rules. That's what the Due Process Clause is about. You have to have notice that what you're doing was wrong before you can be held responsible. And I can't imagine that he had any notice or that anyone in his situation had notice.
Yeah, the Station nightclub was back in 2003 when right. I think more than 100 people were killed, trapped inside the Station nightclub when some flammable material went flying
right.
across.
There was testimony about, fire safety regulations that were ignored.
Yeah.
But then at least the owners knew that what their responsibilities were. This is not the case here.
Judge Gertner, it's nice to see you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Sorry we didn't have.
You're welcome.
Sorry you weren't at the library today, Judge Gertner. But you look like you have an injury there. So.
I do. Yes. Okay.
Good luck with that too. Thank
you
very much with your wrist or hand. Thank you very much. You've been talking with retired federal Judge Nancy Gertner, who's also teaches at the Harvard Law School.
And we should also say he's one of the best criminal defense lawyers on the planet. When she was answering her question before and after her time on the bench, she was as good as they get in terms
oh my
of
goodness.
Criminal defense. So.
She was a wonderful lawyer.
She was
a lawyer for Matthew Stewart. The brother of Charles Stewart. Yeah. And Matthew Stewart is the one that told the authorities that his brother Charles was lying and that there was no black man who killed his sister-in-law. It was his brother. He turned in his brother, basically.
Yep.
And Nancy Gertner was his attorney. Anyway, coming up after a quick break, former President Trump's Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao speaks out against racist remarks the president that would be President Trump posted on his social media platform, True Social. GBH's Callie Crossley has reactions to that story and much more. She's next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. Again, I think it's pretty obvious we're not at the library today, for which we apologize. It was Marjorie's fault. We're joined now in Studio 3 by Callie Crossley. She's the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. Also the host of Basic Black, which airs Friday at 7:30. And you can hear her Callie commentaries on Mondays for GBH's Morning Edition. Hello, Callie Crossley.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Hey to you.
Hey, Callie. Well, let's start with something from your hometown in Memphis, Tennessee. Five police officers face second-degree murder charges for the alleged beating death of Tyree Nichols, 29-year-old father of four, stopped after a traffic stop. We learned that detail about him calling for his mother as he was dying. What do you make of this?
I'm horrified. I'm heartbroken. And I just keep going back to the same question I ask every time one of these scenarios reveals itself. What was there no one of the five to say, hey, wait a minute, hold on, this is a little too much? And I am reminded always of when these scenarios happen of the Laquan McDonald case in Chicago.
Yeah.
He was shot in the back 16 times. But here's the thing that always gets me. Only one officer shot. The rest of them did not shoot, but yet they backed up his report of it and they witnessed it. And if you'll recall, the reason that video came to light, it ended up in the hands of an independent reporter. And he wrote the story, and then other people picked it up, blah, blah, blah. But I've always maintained I have no evidence that it was one of the other officers who could not sleep at night who leaked that tape to the reporter. Because I just don't know how you – I just don't know what happens there. It's, at least in that instance, you know, the rest of them didn't shoot. They witnessed and covered up. But here you have – some of these people played football and were 200 pounds. This guy suffered from Crohn's disease. If people know what that is, it's really hard stomach ailment that causes you to have difficulty keeping weight on. He was 145 pounds. At some point, doesn't something click in?
Well, George Floyd was the same
yeah,
deal.
I understand.
And
I'm
the,
saying.
But you know the what? Non-Derek Chauvins
this
were
is what
charged
I'm
there,
saying.
Too.
But
yeah.
you know what I wanted, yeah. too? We just talked with the retired mm-hmm. Judge Nancy Gertner about this. The speed with which these charges came down really surprised
yeah.
me. And I wondered, is that because they were black cops?
Of course.
And, yeah. and of course, you also say, would they have done this to a white 29-year-old young man? Well, what do you think?
Well, I would agree with you. And I think if they had you know, lost it on a young white man, same circumstances, they'd have to spirit them out of town, because I don't think that would have, you know, I'm amazed now that they released them from jail. I heard that all of them or maybe four of them were released from jail. And maybe that was because they're anticipating, you know, some kind of not good response when the tape is finally released. No, I expected that to be a whole different situation. And I agree with you. The first when I saw the mother after she saw the tape and I thought, OK, this has to be really, really bad. And they were calling for charges. And then, as you say, right away, now we have charges. I thought, oh, this never happens. So, yeah.
You know, one last thing. I know you've been in Boston for a long time, but you grew up in Memphis. Mm-hmm. And Memphis is a poor town.
Yes.
A lot of poverty there. Largely African-American city. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, does that play into any of this? I mean,
I'd like to know myself. I mean, if it plays into anything, I'm thinking to myself, what level of self-hatred are you at? Because I don't know who said it, but in the last couple of days, somebody said, at some point did somebody say this, you know, you could be beating up on your son, your brother, your whatever. You know, I just don't get the disconnect. I'm really struggling around that. And it's horrific. I don't want anybody, by the way, to misinterpret the fact that because I am saying I know that the charges came faster because they were black, because I just believe that, given the history, and we can look at it.
We've never seen
and it never sees that.
Like
it
this.
Does not mean they were not deserved, and I don't think they should have been charged. I want to be clear about
yeah.
that. But this is just beyond. And then the kidnapping, as Judge Gertner just raised, is really something. So no reason to stop him at all. I mean, we've seen this scenario before, but wow. You know, a number of people here in Massachusetts and Boston have long said, and many others repeated, that it's really about that culture, that internal culture of being on the force takes you to a different place. And so in some instances, you know, you forget who you are and who you're beaten up on. And I guess that's what happened here. I don't know.
You know, when we were playing sound from the police chief Davis before, who I think said all the right words and acted as quickly as you two suggested. When you were talking about McDonald before, am I not right that then Mayor Rahm Emanuel tried to sit on this thing absolutely forever and ever and ever.
There was a conspiracy.
Ever, right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, no. Then because he showed up at a school to do a speech, and when he came to the door, all of the students in the school, it was like 2,000 students, screamed 16 shots. Mm. So he could not even speak Because they were like, 16 shots. After you deal with that, then talk to us about it. Yeah.
Speaking of 16, the 1619 project is coming to Hulu. This docuseries from the New York Times.
Yeah.
Here is a little bit from the trailer.
They say our people were born on the water. Like nothing had existed before.
The New York Times published
the 1619 Project.
The legacy of slavery.
We were told by virtue of our bondage, we could never be American. But it was by virtue of our bondage that we became the most American of all. We are the story of America. This is the 1619 Project.
Is that the voice of Nicole Hannah Jones? It is.
Yeah,
she's narrating this
thing? She's been doing... Well, I don't know that that's her voice right there, but she's definitely narrating
it.
Yeah.
Yes, so have you seen any of this?
I have not. It just started last night, the first two episodes. They're doing that thing where they spread it out. You know, I can't stand that. So I have to wait till it's... I can't stand it.
I do that too, so you can get more at once.
I just, you know, wait. And when it's all there, then I can do
then
what I
call
need.
Me.
You know, I can't
stand
it.
Get the popcorn. Yeah. Get the soda.
So whoever is marketing, thinking they're building up whatever, it's not working on me. It makes me go
so
the other
way. So what kind
of
interest do you think there's going to be in this? In the general population?
Now, that is a good question, because I'm not certain. You know, it was so controversial. First, let me say... The people who are producing the hours are incredible. The first two episodes, the ones that ran last night, I guess he did one and then he's doing 106. Roger Ross Williams, not only has he won and directed everything else, he's won Oscars and been nominated for many other Oscars S. So the level of expertise in just filming what is a concept, really, to discuss as you're talking about how to present this history is amazing. So it should be fabulous to help you engage with it. In other words, it's not boring history. It's going to be Nicole Hannah Jones narrating it. But the way that it's presented should be pretty powerful based on just the talent that's here. But I'm interested because, as you recall, there was so much controversy about just her premise, which is that slavery and what happened to the enslaved in this country is A, never been dealt with. That is absolutely true. And B, the tentacles from that impacted every aspect of our current life. And people refuse to see that. But there is documentation and she lays it out. If you've ever heard her speak very clearly and in her book and her articles and all of that. But I think sometimes visually it helps people.
Don't you think it's going to make white people feel bad, though, just like in Florida?
Yeah, so I guess they're not showing it in Florida.
He could do so. You never know with this guy, just saying, he's such a terrible person.
Did you hear, by the way, the quote, the reason I'm even saying that is, I don't know if we brought this up on the air the other day. We were talking about, you know, everybody knows about the Don't Say Gay stuff. Mm-hmm. We're actually going to talk about it, the latest on that with Sue O'Connell in a few minutes. And then they were talking about, you know, you can't teach these black history things either. And this one, I think it's Dunn was his name, his 82-year-old professor was standing up and whatever. I think his name is Fine. The state rep who filed this bill to begin with is saying, no, you can teach anything you want, but you just have to make sure that the white kids don't feel bad because of whatever it is that they... How does one do that, by the way, and why should one do that? Do you know?
I don't understand. Well, first of all, that's an assumption that the white kids will feel bad. You know, the whole part of this is to lay a context so people understand how it happened, where it happened, what happened, how it impacts you today. And I actually think that people who are interested in, remember, in Florida, this was an AP class,
which you can volunteer to take.
And lots of people are interested in all of these connections. And as we've talked many times on this show, there's so much information that we're still learning that we didn't know, that just didn't get reported. I recall, or I need for folks to understand, that a lot of newspapers didn't cover, and they're now apologized many years later, saying, okay, we should have covered civil rights movements. We should have covered what was going on during the time of you know, the Civil War. We just didn't, because we thought we didn't have to. And, you know, you were joking about whether DeSantis can say, don't play 1619 in Florida. But there was a time in this country, not that long ago, where there were certain programs that featured folks of color that were not shown in certain states. They were actively blocked, and they got away with that.
Well, look at what look at what
that
professor
of Sesame Street.
Well, that's correct.
Been blocked.
Look at that professor was talking about that horrible massacre in Florida. Did I know about that?
Roswell?
No.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. Yes.
No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know something else, though. What was I going to say about this? Oh, that this friend of mine who lives in Florida and is tearing her hair out. She can't take it down there anymore. The anti-Semitism, the craziness of Governor DeSantis. Just several days ago, before it was all over the news, sent me pictures of the teachers down in Florida covering up all their books with paper and cardboard because they're afraid that one of their 400 books might
be violent,
violent of his laws, and they'll lose their jobs. I mean, this guy, I just can't see how he can get beyond Florida. Could be wrong. I hope I'm not.
Well, here's the thing that I would like to put this on a larger plane and ask people. One of the reasons that we're behind in certain big areas in the world, and by the way, this is a global economy, right? So you kind of have information so you know how to interact, how to build relationships across cultures, across the world. So you send people out, have no information, and try to compete with the other countries where people know everything. If you've traveled outside of America, everybody knows our stuff. Everybody. You know, how do you feel? You can't answer the question that other people have studied and are really interested in having a conversation with you. And now put that at a higher level where people are charged with making deals or trying to figure out the best possible situation for Americans. And they can't compete because they don't have any information. They got nothing.
No, it's very embarrassing to be in a cab with someone in another country. Not that I've done it that much, but in Ireland, I was humiliated by the cab driver knowing more about the United States than I did. It was really
okay. So, Ron DeSantis is one choice.
Yes,
and another choice is a guy who says about a former secretary in his cabinet. Does Chow Chow have anything to do with Biden's classified documents being sent and stored in Chinatown? Wow. And after directing racism repeatedly at Elaine Chao, again, who worked for him, but had the audacity to resign immediately after January 6th, which I assume was her primary. And by the way, she's the wife of Mitch McConnell, who has not said
one word
peep about the racism directed at his wife by the former president. She finally speaks out.
Yeah, I mean, it's and she gives him a little, you know, lesson, says this Coco Chow thing that he's calling her is a slur, racist nickname. She gives him the history of it. Again, she worked for him. And she said she couldn't take it anymore after he's been doing it for weeks and weeks and months and months and months. And he keeps claiming that, again, as they say in the media, without substantiation, that she and McConnell are tied to China in some way because she is Asian, which again, of course, is another, you know, racist kind of assumption. And I just want to point out that yesterday, Meta, I refuse to call him that, Facebook allowed him back on Instagram and Facebook so he can say this in another format. He said this on his own Truth Social post.
You know what I think is very interesting? How we talked about this during the January 6th hearings, how Liz Cheney shamed the 50 and 60-year-old white guys who were hiding behind their mother's skirts and refused to be coming forward with what they knew about the January 6th insurrection. You had that Cassidy Hutchinson, that 25, 26-year-old young woman who risked her life because she was threatened with death many times. Now you have Elaine Chao coming out and complaining about the Coco Chow thing. Where's her husband?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like Kevin McCarthy's made a fool of himself. Lindsey Graham has made a fool of himself. McConnell's made a fool of himself. It's like they're all a bunch of little chickens, and they wait for the girls.
Well, so Liz Cheney shamed them, and you know what just happened? They just took over the House of Representatives.
That's right.
Boy, they really suffered, didn't they?
Yeah,
she's out of politics.
I'm not sure she shamed them. She revealed who they were.
Well, I guess that's better.
But I'm not sure
the
she shamed
Maya Angelou
them.
Line.
Right.
They have showed us who they are.
Yeah,
we know who
believe
they are.
Them the first time.
But I just think it's very kind of embarrassing for these men that they're such cowards.
Well, let's talk about who. Who was the guy that he took down? Oh, the Texas guy, and talked about his wife.
Yeah, Ted Cruz.
Yeah. But he's still there. He's big.
So
wait,
father,
it's not just his wife.
Yeah.
That Cruz's father was involved in the assassination of JFK.
Yeah, right.
And that his wife was ugly.
Right.
And Ted Cruz is now glued to
him. No problem.
Yeah.
No problem.
Right. This is a little bit of an aside, but it fits here. You know, in the deposition that he had to do on this latest sexual
Jean
assault
Carroll.
With Jean Carroll. He was showed the picture. Do you do this?
The best. Say it again for people to hear this.
So he was showed a picture of Jean Carroll to say, yes, that's Jean Carroll. And he thought it was a picture of his wife. This is
His
former wife.
Yeah.
He's saying he would never be attracted to her because she wasn't his type. But he thought it was Marla. Yeah.
Exactly. And remember when that came out, Jean Carroll is now in her mid-70s or late 70s or something. She's an older woman.
Yeah.
And there was so much ridicule of how, you know, they had to pull out a picture of her when she was 30 years old to kind of say, well, you know, I mean, the ageism in there was just terrible.
But apparently he would be as attractive as he thought it was Marla.
Exactly.
So there you go.
Exactly.
You know.
Okay. Callie Crossey.
Yes.
Tell us the story about this epidural.
Well, this is another one of those stories. People may know by now there's been a lot of belated, but we're now catching up, I hope, of looking into just maternal issues in general in this country. For such a rich country, we stand with the rest of the world at the bottom of being able to take care of women who give birth. And it's particularly egregious for Black women who have said now consistently over and over again that their pain is not recognized, that they are not heard in the hospital. And if people say, okay, there you go again, exaggerating, please just check with, you know, Serena, who makes quite a lot of money, can go anywhere she needs to go to, you know, deliver a baby, and was there for hours screaming, this is not normal, and nobody would respond, and she almost died in birth. Here's this guy, Demetria Shelkoff, anesthesiologist in a public hospital, predominantly Black neighborhood in Brooklyn, who has messed up about a billion times giving epidurals. That's the shot you give to women who are about to give birth. But I didn't know this. The detail was that you test first and to make sure that it's operative, and then you give the full dose. Well, he just was administering full dose of anesthesia. He did this with this young woman, and she said she couldn't breathe and she died. And then only to find out afterwards, he'd done it over and over and over again. So there are many victims of his incompetence. And of course, you know, it must be asked, is that because he was in a predominantly Black neighborhood in a public hospital? There were others who had mentioned that he was doing this horrible thing and nobody paid attention. So here we are, all these deaths later. I don't know that it makes up for the fact that now he's being charged and all of that, because how many people have died while he was essentially experimenting on them?
Well, it doesn't solve the problem.
No.
Because they say in the same story, I don't know if you think you said this, the fatality rate of Black women, this is in New York City.
That's right.
This is not in some backwater.
No.
In New York City, of pregnancy-related complications is 9 times that of white women in New York City.
Well, it's bad here too in Massachusetts.
I know it is.
And we got all the medical innovators in the world, and so there's a lot going on there that obviously needs to be addressed. You know, there's a study that got started over by Brigham and Women looking into this. I mean, there's a lot to try to address it finally, but it's taken a while for people to even recognize it.
Well, this Michael Curry Health Equity Compact that he's been championing, and they finally filed legislation. Not finally.
Yeah.
They filed legislation last week. We're going to talk to him about it next week. Is an important step in the direction of at least shining a light on all this. Can we end on an up note?
Yes.
Some wonderful people, some wonderful chefs, some wonderful restaurant owners in our community made it into the semifinals of the James Beard Awards. We've talked about it a million times, but essentially they're the Oscars of the food industry. You have
That's
a big so smile on
great.
Your face. Tell us who some of them are.
Well, first of all, you know, I'm so excited by Tracy Chang of Pagu because, you know, as I've said to her, and I just saw her a couple of weeks ago at the Embrace thing, putting all of your children through school. Been there so many times, I have a favorite cocktail. And I couldn't remember the name of it, and she said what it was.
What is
that's
it?
Like, lay it on me.
Lay it on me.
Just let you know how many times I've been there.
She knows exactly what you ate last time you were there. It's unbelievable.
She does?
She does.
That food is so great. I had not heard about this Nightshade Noodle Bar until Deborah first wrote about it for The Globe, but it sounds fantastic.
Well, can I just say, I've been there.
And it's
Rachel Miller. Has she been on the radio with us? She Yes, and she also
I saw her on TV
was
with
on
you.
Television
and
with me
when Jim
recently.
Used to have a show.
The food is not good. It is spectacular.
Ooh.
And by the way, she is spectacular. And she has a story working at a bus stop. Where was it?
Wow.
Mississippi or something.
Something like
she
that.
Gets on a bus, comes to Boston, yeah. Then has a breakup, looking for a place to live. She moves to Lynn.
Wow.
And when you talk, we had the state senator from Lynn on the show a few months ago. And we were talking to him, I think off the air, because he was here for a ballot question. And she has helped revitalize downtown Lynn,
wow.
In addition to this fabulous restaurant.
So is it a lot of different noodles? Is it a lot of different noodles?
Well, it's not just a noodle thing. Mm, right. It's the whole spectrum.
Ooh.
A lot of seafood, and it is extraordinarily
okay,
good,
have to
and
get
she's
there.
Great. But there are more local,
yes,
too,
yes,
right?
Yes. So we have this, and I didn't know this guy. He's a semifinalist in the emerging chef category. Vin Lee, heard about it. Cicada Coffee Bar, you've been there? That's in Cambridge.
Yeah, it's on Prospect Street.
Yes, and then, of course, Peruvian Spot La Royale. Those are the same people that have Celeste.
Celeste,
yeah, yes.
Union Square.
And, you know, folks just, you know, swooning, carry on about that. All
that's
that
Maria
food.
Rondeau and Juan Ma Calderon, and it is spectacular.
It is.
On Huron Ave in Cambridge.
It's
and
really
Douglas Williams, who's got
yeah,
Lita
his
in
stuff.
Both Newton and South
you know,
End. I mean, it's
I love
great.
It so much.
It's a tragedy.
Somerville Rebel, the wine and other beverages yeah. category. I want to make sure we
you know,
that. No.
Callie, it's a tragedy for Jim because he knows all these restaurants
yes.
because he had them all on his television show.
Now that I'm not
and they would bring massive amounts of free food to the TV show.
That
and
has nothing to do with it.
With doggy bags.
Are you
every
just,
night.
Are you not just shifting over to the radio now?
Well, that was my plan. We haven't.
Yeah.
Well,
he did give me. Would you give me some breakfast sandwich, some sausage breakfast sandwich, because we couldn't have our lunch at the library?
What was it?
It wasn't like any of these nice dishes from Pago
right,
or anything like that.
It was like a 50-cent freezer
yeah.
thing. I got it at Market Basket.
50-cent freezer thing.
What
that's
are you talking
not
about?
La Royale.
No,
that's not what we're talking about.
Exactly.
By the way,
that's what you gave me.
You should
have
check
this,
out
Marjorie. Cost
some
me 50
of these
cents.
People, best chefs New England, some of the best chefs nationally.
It's
some
amazing.
Of the best new restaurants in America. But the point is, a lot of wonderful things are being done, not only in great restaurants, but by some incredibly wonderful community-focused people.
And you had
way.
Irene Lee on, and she's getting
she
an
was
award.
Yesterday,
yes,
yeah.
Oh,
yes,
my
yes.
God.
She won the
she's
leadership
been,
award.
Oh, my God.
She's
those
fabulous.
Dumplings,
yeah.
which
yeah,
you can
great.
Buy now and freeze
so
them.
So wonderful. Yeah, it's really, I mean, I remember her when she was, not starting out, but when she was making the point that Asian food is so often undervalued. I do want to point out that in this list, there is a heavy Asian influence.
Yeah, there is,
and that's something to be noted about either or both a change in the palate of Americans who are really interested in this food and also just the quality of the product.
You know, by the way, I would just want to say one other thing, and then I'm hoping we're going to get the chef owner in,
under the
and
radar.
You're going to participate with us if
okay.
we do.
Okay.
Callie sent me to a restaurant
oh, yes.
last week called Chef Dave's.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
In Chestnut Hill.
Hill.
Yes.
Yes.
Let me just tell you, unbelievable.
Yes.
We're going to reach out to him,
okay.
Chef Dave, and if we
yeah.
have him in, you'll
yeah.
join
that's
us.
Right.
Oh, yes, because
together.
I've known him for 1,000 years.
He's going to start this grift right here.
No, it is
radio.
Not a grift. It was,
no, he's,
I paid for
I
everything.
Told him,
it was not
I
a
told him about it. I encouraged him to go.
You were horrible.
Did I not tell you about
you
it?
You did.
Tell
that's
you?
Why I went.
Yeah,
I never heard of
I'm looking
him.
Forward to a lot of free lunches
what are you
in 2023.
You're getting free chocolate in a few minutes.
I know. I'm very excited about that.
What are you doing this weekend, Kelly Cross?
We're doing our LGBTQ roundtable, and some of the issues we're talking about are some legislatures moving to ban drag shows in public spaces, and that's separate from the move, the federal ban to ban drag story time, which I know you all have talked about quite a bit on
yeah.
the show. The Pope has said homosexuality is not a crime. It's a sin, he says, but not a crime, and that's significant in the world. And then in Springfield, the federal judge rules that it's okay for kids who do not want to tell their parents that they have changed their gender identities because they don't feel comfortable with them to keep that private. So this is big stuff. And then we're doing a special segment with Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Eastern Massachusetts because this is National Mentoring Month and there's a huge push to get more adult male mentors, but also a huge push to get some Latinx mentors and for the kids who are waiting in line for that help.
Is that Robert Lewis's joint? Or,
no. That's, no, this is
okay.
Mark O'Connell is, I believe that's his last name. Please, Mark, if I got your last name wrong, I apologize. Can I just squeeze in one thing?
Yes.
Of course you can.
Ruth Carter getting nominated.
Oh, yeah, we forgot about that.
Another local.
Oh, my gosh. She's from Springfield. She won the Oscar for the first Black Panther. But if you have not seen Black Panther Wakanda Forever, just watch the first scene, which I have said Ryan Coogler, the director, could just have gone home after that. The movie is still great. But the clothing,
the design,
that first scene is just mind-blowing because of her design.
She went to Springfield Tech, right?
Yeah.
Did she not?
Yeah. And, I mean, it's just... So I'm so happy for her she got nominated again.
Great.
Yeah.
Callie, we'll be checking you out this weekend.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
See you soon.
Yeah.
Callie Crossy, thank you very much. I love that jacket. Just wanted to tell you that. You're looking stunning today. Callie Crossy is the host of Under the Radar, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. She's also the host of Basic Black, which airs Fridays at 7:30. And you can hear or read Callie's commentaries on Monday for GBH's Morning Edition. You can also get them online, but you want to hear them Monday mornings. Thank you very much, Callie Crossy.
Thanks, Kelly.
Coming up. After a quick break, we're going to talk with our media maven, Sue O'Connell. She's going to delve into the M&M candy controversy. She'll join us next. Stay with us. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Trusted. Local. News. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR. What matters to you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are not live at the Boston Public Library. In fact, we're not anything at the Boston Public Library. We had technical problems. We'll be back on Tuesday with Ask the Governor at noon and Ask the Mayor at 1:30. Today, here to take on the social norms and abnormalities of the day is media maven Sue O'Connell. Sue is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News and contributor to Current on NBCLX and NECN. Hello, Sue.
Hello, good day.
Good day to you,
Hello.
Too.
Hello.
Good day.
Wow,
good
look
day.
At you. See, you're smiling over there.
Well, I'm just fresh from TV, not Jim's TV, old TV show.
Yeah.
But I'm going to start asking
you just
for
did
food.
That?
Yeah, not today, yesterday, but I'm going to start asking for food. I didn't think about that.
By the way, that is the gimmick.
So, Sue O'Connell, I saw you at one of your many jobs. This was NBC 10 Boston. Yeah. I think you were hosting the first time we had a female mayor, woman of color mayor. And it was a whole different feel. It was the MGM New Music Hall there down in the Fenway. What'd you think of the evening?
I thought she is amazing in how she plans things and what she wants happening. I mean, over the years, the mayors have had, Menino had it at Faneuil Hall. I think Walsh had it in Symphony Hall once. They've had it in various locations. But what she did, which is absolutely brilliant, was she, I'm told, I wasn't there, that there were pictures of the city employees. And so as they walked into the hall, they saw pictures of themselves. The whole first 10 to 15 minutes of the speech, all about uplifting the city employees, uplifting the new appointed hires of her departments, showing and telling their individual
life stories,
where they came from, the neighborhoods they came from. Now, you might remember there was concern during, or she was concerned, I imagine, her campaign during the election, that the city hall worker, the worker vote was going to go towards Anissa Asabi George, that the people were polling more. And you can't win to be mayor unless you get those votes from City Hall. So what she was doing was stacking the deck in the hall for herself, so she had a warm welcome, not just for herself, but, emphasizing the team, uplifting other people, and basically really endearing herself to the families of the city employees and the city employees themselves and to the neighborhoods that these workers came from, so that by the time she got to the nitty-gritty of the speech, it was just a love fest.
It was more like
a pep rally than a standard. And I don't know, do you guys remember, there used to be some grumbling from audience members at these State of the Cities.
No grumbling.
That if there was a union
standing
issue,
O's,
you know,
yeah.
that maybe somebody in the audience,
we're
like
sometimes picketing,
right?
Menino,
no, nope. at Faneuil Hall that time. There's no grumbling at all.
Plus,
in this audience.
If we may be sexist and superficial here for a moment, she looked spectacular.
Yeah, she looked great.
She walked out in this absolutely gorgeous dress, little podium just by itself in the middle of this big wide stage. I mean, it was a very impressive. Yeah. Evening, I thought.
You know, let me just say one thing, though, about this, what you described a minute ago. I have a friend who, I hope if he's listening, he takes this in the right way, is tough and somewhat cynical. He thought that whole thing, the vibe that laid out was a we kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That it was not like I'm the boss.
Oh, no,
deal,
absolutely.
But it created
this
beautiful feel.
Yep.
Of a team, which
absolutely.
Is a really wonderful thing for those workers and for the relatively new mayor.
She is,
I think,
probably the most disciplined and calculated elected official I think I've ever seen. And what she is able to do is demonstrate this power that she has by uplifting others.
That's a great
way
to put it.
So she was able to both put the spotlight on her as a team leader while uplifting her team. And that's a delicate thing to do, and she really pulled it
off.
And
she's also a brilliant person.
You think?
Obviously, yeah, I really do.
I can play the piano and also run a business and raise the whatever.
Exactly. Two little kids at home. Have you heard her play the piano? I mean, she's
yes.
spectacular. She could be giving performances somewhere.
All right, enough.
You're just
of that.
Jealous, Jim, because she's a girl.
Whatever. I'm not. No, I'm.
She hasn't run the marathon like Jim. How about
thank
that?
You.
That's right. Well, that's what he says anyway.
Well, I've got proof.
Pictures,
I'm like
yeah.
somebody else we know. So, on a much more important topic, let's discuss the Twitter wars between drag queens, one of them being George Santos and others being sort of alum in most cases of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah, so there's a number of things. It's not a great a great climate for drag across the country, as Callie was talking about earlier, and we talk about this weekend on Under the Radar. It's Nazis are showing up, and all these laws being passed. But meanwhile, in the real world of the gays, you don't want to tick off a drag queen, okay? I have had the misfortune of putting a drag queen on the cover of one of my publications without her approval. Did not go well. Went through every copy of Jacques and tore her picture out and then said bad things about me up on the stage. They also are trained like assassins to be able to really bring you down with, cutting comments. And, like we said last week, George Santos, not a drag queen. It's like, when you say somebody's a porn star.
Yeah.
Just because you're in a porno doesn't mean you're a star.
That's
right.
You
just happen to be.
They're the porn hangers on.
Right. He's in drag. He's not a drag queen. And a number of the RuPaul alumni of the RuPaul drag race really went after Santos, who I have to say is now, we were talking about this earlier in several newsrooms I've been in over the past few days. He's kind of becoming endearing because he's kind of going with the whole thing now.
Well, after denying that he'd even done it.
Well, that and just
he
like,
said he was just having fun.
Having people take picture selfies with him while he's out in Washington, D.C. He's kind of become like one of those Times Square guys, like the Times Square Spider-Man, right? So as long as he doesn't
or
do
the
any...
Naked Cowboy.
Yes,
you ever seen
yes,
him?
With the, yeah. With, yeah, so
I have, actually.
Yep, so... He's been complaining on Twitter about how all of the nighttime talk shows have comics to impersonate him, and he thinks they're doing a bad job. And Trixie Mattel, one of the RuPaul Drag All-Stars, said maybe the source material was weak to Santos. I have to be careful not to say some of these drag names. I'm not sure if they're okay. And Santos gave it back when he was saying, yes, I was just fun at had fun at a festival. And one of the other drag queens said, well, yes, I'm not an actor. I was young and at a festival, too. And then Santos said, it's all good. At least I won my race against the fan favorite, which is kind of giving back to the person who lost at RuPaul. So we're now in this weird world. Where
He also is trashing John Lovitz.
Yes.
Who I guess on SNL.
He was on, was it SNL?
Wherever.
No, I think they all have one.
He said
it
was
it's
terrible.
Like a cottage industry now.
So he responds after Lovitz being trashed, says, thanks for the review to Santos, this is on Twitter, and advice, you're right, I do need to step up my game. My pathological liar character can't hold a candle to you. The lower rent.
He was
gets,
on the Tonight Show.
My apologies.
That's
the happier
okay. It's hard
I am.
To keep up.
So on a much more serious note than George Santos's travails, there's a story that talking about how trans people are moving out of the UK because of a bunch of behaviors by government that are anti-trans. And I got the sense that the numbers may not be huge, but the fear is real. And you sort of pair that with stories I've read, a lot of stories in the last couple of weeks, about LGBTQ people moving out of Florida, or at least beginning to plan moving out of Florida because of Santos's Don't Say Gay and Beyond.
Yeah, I think, you know, the issue in the UK is one of rolling back or not accepting some things that other parts of the European or parts of the European Union do, and what Scotland is doing, which is allowing to people to change their name without having to go through a medical exam or some ridiculousness.
Oh, that's what it was.
You're right. You know, it's the language that's used in criticizing this that brings up the feelings of some that might result in anger, distrust, and hostility towards trans people. I mean, we see this. We're now this far into this country where we know if somebody gets up and says, you should do this, these people are the enemy, some people are going to respond, right? It doesn't mean everybody. And you just need a few people to respond in a way that makes trans people feel endangered. And they're moving to other places like Greece and Germany. Germany has been a very welcoming country for trans individuals. And here in the United States, you know, you can just imagine being a trans person when you're watching all of these ridiculous efforts by people to, you know, both ban drag brunches, not that trans people are drag queens by any means, but just these efforts of attacks on gender identity and how it's going to result in people being more violent to others, those who are already prone to violence. So, you know, even when we're talking about athletes and trans athletes, it's important to try and ask people to focus on the issue and the ideology of it and not make it personal, because there's all sorts of people who are feeling impacted by this and who are going to be in danger. And again, within our community, the folks who are most targeted are Black trans women. Overwhelmingly, they are more likely to be harmed and killed. So, you know, just to make sure that when we're talking about issues, we try not to make it into an attack on people.
Well, there's another thing, which is why we brought this up, is I'm guilty, at least here. I often talk a lot about policy that concerns me, good or bad, and don't talk enough about the human impact of the policy. I mean, teachers in Florida, you read almost every single day, leaving the profession or living in fear because if they make the wrong... You were talking about the books before that were covered up for fear they'd be violated.
And we've talked in the past about gay married teachers, so they can't...
They can't talk about... Right.
If they talk in the hallway.
If they answer a kid's question
Or if they're overheard. Overheard, if you said, hey, Marjorie, how's your wife this weekend? You know that the kid's going to go home and tell on them.
So the point is, it's not just... I know this is obvious to a lot of you, and you're just nodding saying, why do you even need to say this? Well, I think it does need to be said. It's not just horrible policy. It's horrible policy that is making, as you say, vulnerable lives, the lives of vulnerable people even more difficult. And it's sadistic, and we should wrap our arms around our fellow men, women, all kinds of people. So can we talk about the only thing Marjorie really wanted to talk about?
Yes, I do. Story of the
month. I want to talk about the fact that apparently M&M's has decided that the green M&M's should have different footwear. And this has really upset the right, including Fox News' Tucker Carlson, who's a big star on their evening show. And he complains about the wokeness of M&M's. And he says that the candy's characters' changes have made the M&M's less sexy.
Yeah. So I just want to point out, this is my favorite story, I think, of the year thus far. And it's only January, I know. But first of all, Tucker Carlson and the radical conservative right, who are so concerned about drag brunches, are okay with saying that M&M should have a sexual gender reveal, that they should be sexy.
Point.
Tucker Carlson doesn't want his kids at a drag brunch, but he's very concerned that his M&M's aren't sexy enough to eat. I just want to point that out. Second of all, remember we've had raisins that sing. We've got a piece of dough that's naked that if you poke his belly, he giggles.
That's
Pillsbury Doughboy is naked?
Yes, he's naked. We have candy.
Like, he is naked,
all of
actually.
Our candy spokespeople don't have any pants on. Like, there's just this just nudity and sexuality everywhere. So what M&M does, which is owned by Mars Incorporated, the Mars Candy Couple, last year they decided to make one of the M&M's more sexy. And they gave her eyelashes and they gave her shoes. Now, I'm told...
Sneakers.
Sneakers? Before that, they gave her high heels.
I didn't know that.
Told by an industry expert that this was an elaborate plan that has worked so far well in their future, they can't stand it. Backlash. Why are you making candy sexy? Oh, my gosh, don't make candy sexy. So in January, this month, they announced, we're going to make them less you know, less gender roles. So the female M&Ms are going to have comfortable shoes like me.
Yeah.
And they're going to wear sneakers like me, and they're going to wear less makeup like me. And their arms are not going to be this tan color anymore. They're going to be the color of the M&Ms, just like in real life. It's not this flesh tone. You know, remember how color, like pink used to be, the crayon used to be flesh, like that's the only flesh that existed. So Tucker Carlson has a conniption and reacts on the air saying it's woke candy, the candy's not sexy anymore. I wouldn't want to go out and have a drink with any of this candy. I mean, he just totally loses his mind. And then what is
that's
it?
A bit extreme.
What do the M&M folks do? They announce we're going to put them on hiatus. We are retiring indefinitely. The spokespeople, the candy spokespeople. Spokes candy. We're going to retire them indefinitely. And then what do? They announce that Maya Rudolph, America's sweetheart, she's going to be the spokesperson. And when is this all going to be revealed to us what's happening? In an ad on the Super Bowl. Isn't that brilliant?
Do you ever sit back and worry about how much you know about certain things?
I guess, by the way, I wonder, you know, Tucker Carlson, I'm not a fan. But he's good at what he does, if you listen to his monologues. But it does seem, even for him, a little extreme to get all worked up about the footwear and the sexiness.
No, they love anything that they can say about this woke. Like, anytime you try to make it seem like it's just equitable or equal, you know, when you look at the things that we have had since our grandparents were in place, it was the same thing with Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben. And suddenly, you know, you want to change it because you realize, you know what, this isn't so good. This isn't so kosher that we're using images of African Americans who have had nothing to do with profiting from this. We're just off their reputations. Maybe we should change it to make it more current to actually reflect history. And their heads blow up. And this is what I love about this is it looks like Tucker has just fallen for this hook, line, and sinker. And I would have loved to be in the Mars marketing office when he lost it. Like, what a celebration they must have had that now here we are giving them even more free advertising.
By the way, one of our colleagues put up a photograph of the Pillsbury Doughboy.
Indeed.
Now, there's two things that are troubling.
He is nude.
He's wearing
one,
a hat.
He is naked.
Yep.
Except for the hat. And two, he seems to be genitalia free,
as far as I can tell. And if you poke his belly, he goes, oh.
Exactly. Well, wouldn't you?
I know.
Do you know you could buy one of those sweatshirts for Christmas?
My mother gave me one. I had this thing about the Pillsbury Doughboy. I don't even know. I don't even want to go into what that might have meant. But she gave me one for Christmas that I still have.
Wait, what is it? I don't understand.
It can make
what it
a sound.
Yeah. Oh, you mean if you poke the sweatshirt?
Yeah. No, I had a little statue, a little thing of the Pillsbury. That's
really
why
nice.
I know he was naked. Listen, if Tucker Carlson and everybody is worried about sexualization of children, go after the toddlers and tiaras pageants. Okay,
exactly.
There's a billion places that he could have some concern.
Did you create one of your great columns? I think you were still at the Herald. This is not a Globe column. When you called them prostitutes. What are prostitutes?
Well, I stole that. It wasn't an original
line. It was a
line. I think Jennifer Lopez, didn't she? Somebody
talked about. What was a prostitute?
Well, it was about if you went to buy clothing, you get a daughter, for 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 6X.
Yeah.
It was all
like
this sexualized
It's like the Bratz dolls. Your choice are low-priced prostitute, medium-priced prostitute, or high-end prostitute.
Or you go, when they go to the bar mitzvahs and bas mitzvahs in 7th grade, you go to try to find a dress with sleeves.
No, don't
you
exist.
You couldn't find it. Yeah. It was all these, you know, low-cut sleeveless things.
One of your finest contributions.
Yeah, well, it was the sexualization of preschoolers, and that's what we call them, prostitutes. I think I stole it from somebody. I don't know who said it. Anyway, Sue O'Connell, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you
for
straightening us out on
this
M&M controversy. I've been very upset about
this. Remember when the green M&Ms, like there was that joke that the writers, the bands backstage only wanted to have green M&Ms or like Bon Jovi or somebody, Van Halen. M&Ms have been in the public sphere for years, so brava.
I always thought the red M&M was the one you really wanted, no? Isn't that what you
they
wanted?
They taste exactly the same, don't they?
No, I don't think so.
Remember when we did the Skittles test on air? Do you remember that? Yeah, where you
what, to see if they tasted different?
Yeah, they all taste the same?
The exact same?
They do?
Yeah, they have a scent on them, and if you smell it, you think that that's what it tastes. But if you hold your nose and eat a Skittle, they all taste the same.
Well,
did it here.
Wait a minute.
I'm glad I have an institutional memory for you guys.
Flavored Lifesavers, they do taste different.
don't know.
By the way, I don't know one person who's had a lifesaver in 30 years except for you. Do you know that?
Well, Marjorie, she has tissues up her sleeve, and then she takes out a little lifesaver during the movie.
Okay,
that's
fine,
right.
Goodbye.
That's what Miss Crispo did, a living fossil in my high school health
class.
Health
teacher.
Okay, Sue O'Connell, thank you very much.
Bye, Sue.
We've been speaking with Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Window, South End News, contributor to Current on NBC, LX, and NECN. Thank you very much, Media Maven. After a quick break, we've been talking about chocolate. Well, you don't have to travel to Switzerland to taste artisan chocolate. In just a moment, we're going to talk and taste with chocolate sommelier, that's how I say it, sommelier Victoria Kitchuk about the best chocolate in Massachusetts. That's next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Thank God for chocolate. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are not at the Boston Public Library. I hope people know that by now. Our apologies. We had technical difficulties. We will not have technical difficulties on Tuesday when our first of monthly Ask the Governors with the new Governor Maura Healey. She'll join us 12 to 1, 1:30 to 2:30. No, that's not a mistake. 1:30 to 2:30, Ask the Mayor, as in Michelle Wu. You know, usually in the slot on Fridays, it's our live music Friday. We'll return to that next week. We had so today we're trying something a little different, a little sweeter. It's a few weeks until Valentine's Day, and who doesn't love chocolate? We're joined by chocolate sommelier, owner of Coco Beantown, Victoria Kitchuk. Did I get your pronounce it right?
Perfect.
Thank you very much, Victoria. Ahead of the Chocolate Expo this weekend in Wilmington, she'll tell you about that too. You can get tickets at thechocolateexpo.com. Hello there.
Hi there.
And welcome. I don't think her mic is on. Is it on? Say it again.
She might have turned it up.
Say hi.
Hello?
No, that doesn't affect the mic. It affects what she hears. We're good. Brian fixed
it. All good?
Hi there, Victoria.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you.
Hi.
Okay. So I love the fact that you were born on National Chocolate Chip Day. What else could you be but a chocolate expert having been born on that particular day? But before we get to what we're talking about, this expo and all the just chocolates you brought in here, there's a big controversy raging about one of the green M&Ms changing its footwear and getting rid of his eyelashes, and Fox News host Tucker Carlson is very upset because the M&Ms are less sexy now. Do you have an opinion on this raging controversy about M&Ms?
I have many opinions, but I did want to speak to the question about whether red M&Ms taste differently.
And they don't, right?
You technically could derive a slight flavor nuance because the red dye that they use is made from crushed beetles. It's why they're not vegan.
Crushed what?
Crushed beetles.
Well, we're going to discuss bugs in a few minutes, actually.
So
red M&M's covering is made from crushed beetles?
Yeah, red dye number 40. It's in lots of things like fruit punch and other things. It's why it's not a vegan product.
Well, obviously she knew.
Yeah.
I mean, she just told us that, did she not? Can you tell us what a chocolate sommelier is? What do you do exactly?
Yeah, it's definitely not a line of work you hear about a career day at school.
But I'm bummed.
Yeah,
you.
It's kind of like an Oscar seat filler or flavor guru at Ben & Jerry's. Usually when I tell people what I do for a living, they feel a bit of retroactive anger at their high school guidance counselor. But a chocolate sommelier is very basically someone who does similar work to what a wine sommelier does in that they educate about, in my case, chocolate. I know how to curate pairings. I do events.
You do tours and things for people?
Yeah, my company, Coco Beantown, we do chocolate tours in Boston, tasting events, pairing events. And I get to write chocolate purchases off on my taxes. So it's a, adult achievement unlocked. But I don't make chocolate. I'm not a chocolatier. I'm not a chocolate maker. I don't own a chocolate shop. I specifically educate and talk about and curate things related to craft chocolate.
So if you go on a tour of Boston chocolate-wise. What are you seeing?
So we have a lot of wonderful, not only dedicated chocolate shops, but also cafes, shops, bakeries that do interesting things with chocolate. And we actually have a remarkable amount of history related to chocolate in Boston.
What's the history?
Yeah. Oh, the very first chocolate factory in North America was Baker's Chocolate in North Dorchester. Yeah.
Wow.
The very first one, the very first drinking chocolate house. They used to, just like we have coffee houses, they used to have chocolate houses were a thing. They started in Europe as a tradition, initially gentlemen only, and then they let women in. I think they didn't want to share.
They were drinking chocolate?
Drinking chocolate drinks as a social activity. And the reason why the saucer was invented, it wasn't for tea. It was initially so ladies in their beautiful gowns before shout sticks would not dribble chocolate onto their dresses.
Was there liquor in the chocolate? Or was it just plain old chocolate?
Herbs, spices. Okay. Right. And then the very first one in North America also was in Boston. Drinking chocolate houses used to be a thing.
You know, before we get in, we're going to get into specific chocolate makers who are local, which is great, or which are local. I'm glad you did this. I don't think I'm telling tales out of school. Yesterday was the farewell for Brian McGrory at the Globe, and I went.
Yes.
And Shirley the Young got me. It's like a fortress at the Globe. Shirley the Young got me in, and she bought this really expensive, wonderful chocolate from some Swiss chocolate maker at the Pru that begins with an L, that's supposedly one of the best in the world.
Laudera.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And it's literally like buying diamonds, practically. And, you know, that's so most of us operate in the assumption that's where the best chocolate in the world comes from. Where does Greater Boston, where does New England, Massachusetts chocolate manufacturing rank in terms of quality in the world of people like you?
We're really fortunate. And I think it kind of also is a nice nod to the fact that we have history that goes back to the very founding of this country, that we were chocolate lovers from the beginning in Boston and Massachusetts. We have some of the current winningest craft chocolate makers in the world, one of which I brought a sample of today, but they're doing amazing things.
Okay, so we wanted to pretend like we're interested in the background. We're not. We're really interested in the chocolate. So why don't you start telling us what we're eating, and that'll give you an opportunity to talk about the chocolate maker.
Sure, absolutely.
So what's first?
So let's start with the one I just kind of hinted at, the Goodnow Farms piece. And your little plates have little labels along it.
Okay.
Goodnow Farms actually is doing a special release that they were going to do next week, but they moved it up to coincide with this broadcast.
The Valentine's bar,
so,
we heard they moved it up. Yeah.
So you're having their dark chocolate passion fruit. Now, if you want to do me a favor.
Oh, it's very different.
Yeah. If you can, I know it's not maybe ideal for radio, but if you can hold it on your tongue and let it melt a little bit and not chew it so much.
Uh-huh.
What we're trying to do is
how long do I leave here?
We're trying to let the cocoa butter, which I know folks can't see, but I'm holding up a piece of cocoa butter that is the good fat that's in chocolate.
How long do I leave it here?
Until it melts.
Oh my God.
If you took a big piece, it might take longer, so you can chew a little.
Fabulous.
But the cocoa butter, as a natural fat, is a flavor delivery device. Just like in cooking, you add more oil or butter, it changes the way flavors get delivered. When we have good quality chocolate, if we let it melt, we get the full impact of all the nuances, and you'll notice flavor changes as it melts, which is
sublime. Where is Goodnow Farms, by the way?
They are not too far. They're based in Sudbury.
Oh.
They actually converted a 225-year-old barn into a small batch chocolate factory, and they are winning awards at the International Chocolate Awards, Academy of Chocolate Awards. They're really, really fabulous. And we're so fortunate that they sent this bar. It literally got wrapped yesterday. They got taken out of the molds, what you're having right now.
Well, that's a big deal, the freshness.
Well, I was just going to say, can you, I don't know if you know you're a chocolate sommelier. You probably know that.
Yeah.
Can you, if you didn't know, and Goodnow, for example, gave you some old chocolate bar as opposed to the bar that was produced yesterday, could you tell just from the taste?
Freshness, there sometimes, if it gets to a certain point, chocolate never goes bad in the sense of spoilage, but there are crystal shapes that break down that can change textures.
This is fabulous.
But the mouthfeel definitely can give you a hint.
I have a question.
Sorry.
This is not one of the chocolate tasting things, but the Lindt chocolate, L-I-N-D-T chocolate, they have a store right across the street from the Boston Public Library, which we're normally
They're not local.
I know, but I'm just asking a quick question.
Yeah.
When you buy the chocolate there, to me, it tastes a million times better than if you buy it at CVS or any place else.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's like a year old at CVS.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. It's the newness, isn't it?
it could be partly that there are certain things that happen. Certainly, Lindt is a higher quality chocolate than, say, your Mars, Nestle, Hershey candy bar. Mm-hmm. But the chocolate that I usually deal with and what you have in front of you are a sort of a different segment. We'd call it craft bean to bar small batch chocolate. Okay. So not making thousands of bars a day. These folks sometimes make as few as 100 bars.
Yeah, which
batch.
Is the place we're reading about that makes only 100 a day? If you bought 100 bars, you'd buy them out. Which one of those is this?
Actually, Somerville Chocolates, Eric Parks. I believe he has been on your show before.
Yes.
He has a sample of
white chocolate.
White chocolate with saffron.
Are you kidding me?
So good quality white chocolate is a whole different animal than the stuff that usually gets a bad rap. That's waxy. It has too much corn syrup. It's cloyingly sweet. This stuff is made with that pure cocoa butter. And so as it melts, it's going to coat your mouth in this creamy, clean melt. There's a little saffron on there, which we all know is a really delicate but beautiful spice. And he makes a few hundred bars at a time. So he's a micro-batch maker.
Taz is still in Somerville, too, right?
Yes.
They've been here a lot, the couple behind that. You know, can we go to another one? That's delicious, by the way.
Good.
Chickasset. And the reason I'm going to Chickasset is I go to Truro almost every summer, at least through it. I don't think I've ever been there. And who calls us quite regularly, listens to the show? Josiah Mayo. Now, do you know why he's famous?
Yes.
Has nothing to do with chocolate, even though the chocolate, I'm told, is great, and I'll find out in a minute. Was he famous for?
He was driving the boats of the man who got swallowed by a whale.
Exactly.
The summer.
And I have to say, I didn't believe that at all until he called. And he makes it so compelling that it's real. So Chickasset chocolate. It is in Truro, right?
Yes,
it is
correct.
In Truro.
Yep.
And what are we eating from Chickasset?
So a little, what we call an inclusion bar. Inclusion is the word we use for chocolate bars that have something added for flavor or texture. So this is the Monomoy Mochaccino bar. It's a single origin bean from Dominican Republic. And then they added some George Howell coffee, which we know George Howell has
fabulous.
A great lineage
fabulous
here in Boston.
Coffee. Wow, that is spectacular, too. Okay, keep going on the list so we can try to cover them all.
Yeah. So we also have, for salty and sweet fans, from Boho Chocolate, which is out in Florence, the owner, Charlie Burke, which if your first name's Charlie, you have to have a chocolate factory. It's just by law. So this is a great, if folks have never had, I don't know if you folks have ever had chocolate-covered potato chips before, but
this is a chocolate-covered potato chip?
So it has pieces of, that piece right there has pieces of
salted potato chip in it.
So salty and sweet. That one you can chew.
Thank you.
It's got a nice little crunch to it.
Oh, yeah.
Salt, sweet. Just kind of hits all those very snackable things. He also does single origin bars, but, it's fun to do something that's a little whimsical at
Boho,
the same time.
Where in Western Mass is this again?
Florence.
Florence, okay.
Yeah.
So I have a couple more questions. This is delicious.
But
it's much less sweet. Than regular. So what are the characteristics of this kind of small batch chocolate that, again, are not like the Lindt chocolate, which you say is higher quality than Hershey, but it's not like this? What's the difference?
A lot of your mass-produced industrial chocolate is going to be more sugar-forward than cocoa-forward. When you have makers who are working with cacao beans that are high quality, they have flavor notes that range quite a spectrum. If you've heard that wine can have about 200 flavor profiles, cacao has over 400. So that's why it's important to have people like me that can speak to these things. If you have a good bean, you don't have to add a lot to it to make it a beautiful bar.
Are we supposed to be eating this thing?
No, that's just for to
what is
look
this
at.
Again?
It's cocoa butter. It's pure cocoa butter.
So it's good I didn't take a bite of this.
Yeah.
Is that what you're
saying? Touch and feel. You can smell it. It also makes a good moisturizer. Cocoa butter goes in body care products as well.
Okay, good. So now, wait, can we go down the rest of these?
Oh, okay.
These
all
right. We want to give them as
I
much
have a lot
play
of
as we
here,
can.
Jim.
Okay, fine. What is the Marjorie's got a lot of questions. I
sure.
want you to know. Okay, what is Tangle chocolate?
Tangle chocolate.
Where's that
so,
from?
She's a newer maker. She just got started during the pandemic. She makes these wonderful little chocolate thins.
Very thin.
Yeah, this is a newer recipe that's got sage butter. So sage infused butter in the milk chocolate.
Oh my god,
which is kind of savory, but it kind
of
works.
Two of us.
Right,
melting your mouth.
Two losers. So.
We're not losers, Jim. We're eating a lot of chocolate.
She's in Northampton, and she's going to be opening a shop later this year. She's working on that.
That
So who buys this? Because, like I said, the average person is probably going to get the Mars bar, the Hershey bar. They're going to get maybe some other higher Godiva, whatever. Where's the market for this kind of chocolate? Because it's got to be more expensive.
Yeah, definitely it's more expensive. But I always, there's a lot of reasons why. The most important reason is that the makers are working with the farmers to make sure they get paid fairly. And that's probably the biggest kind of ethical reason for it. But folks will say to me, why would I spend $10 more for a Kraft chocolate bar when I can get a Snickers bar for $3? And if the difference between the kind of everyman category and the luxury category is only $10 in chocolate, when else does that happen, right? It doesn't happen in cars. It doesn't happen in shoes.
That's a great point. Right?
It's an affordable luxury. Yep.
Also, can I tell you, I don't know anything about chocolate. This is far better than whatever you get in the...
Yeah.
So we have one left. What is this? Costa... What's the name of this?
Castro Novo.
What is that?
So she's actually
not...
Is
that this thing?
Yes. Okay. So this is actually the 2019 Golden Bean Award winner. There's only one of those awarded a year.
Golden Bean.
Is what we call a dark milk chocolate. Mm-hmm. So it's high cocoa content like in dark chocolate, but still contains milk, so kind of a hybrid. She's not currently based in Massachusetts. She's actually based in Florida, but she was born and raised in Walpole and educated here. And she also originally was an environmental scientist who worked for the DCR to map green areas in Boston to account for climate change. And when she moved to Florida, transitioned to making chocolate. So all of her chocolate is environmentally sustainable as well as delicious.
Unfortunately, we don't promote anything from Florida. Okay, so...
Her heart is still here.
When is this... what is this expo deal and how does this work? Where's the next thing coming up?
Yeah, so Sunday, Cocoa Bean Town, we're going to be doing a presentation on Massachusetts chocolate history at the Chocolate Expo at the Shriners Auditorium in Wilmington. There's going to be a lot of chocolatiers, chocolate makers there, other food things too. If you're there all day, you'll be able to get snacks that are other things than chocolate if that's your persuasion.
And what do? You pay a fee and you get samples all over the joint, or how does it work?
There's going to be sampling. There's going to be presentations and entertainment. There's a lot of different products that people can learn about, and their tickets are currently on sale through the Chocolate Expo website. All the VIP tickets are gone at this point, but there are timed tickets for the day. It's from 10 to 6.
What if you have a VIP, you get to wipe like melted chocolate
all
over your body?
About that.
What do you do?
Maybe they have the big fountain. They have one of those fountains, maybe those chocolate fountains. You see those at weddings sometimes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet they don't approve of those chocolate fountains in your world of high-end chocolate. Probably not.
If I know where the chocolate comes from, I can usually tell when I taste it.
Yeah. So could you, because these are all local, with the exception of the Florida deal, but I know she's got a Walpole thing, can you go down the whole list one more time? So if people are trying to write down what they were, quickly if you can.
Sure thing. Chiquette Chocolate in Truro, Monomoy Mochaccino Bar, the Goodnow Farms just released Pure Passion Fruit Bar based in Sudbury. Boho Chocolate, based in Florence. He does a milk chocolate with potato chip. Castro Novo Chocolate with dark milk. And Somerville Chocolate, who operates out of the Aeronaut Brewery. He has a white chocolate with saffron.
Oh, and Tangle.
And Tangle Chocolate. Tangled. Sorry. Yeah. Also based in Northampton. And she does beautiful little gift boxes. So they're great for Valentine's Day.
So how do your parents feel that you're a chocolate sommelier? What do they say to their friends? What does their kid do?
Well, my mom likes to say I was born with chocolate on my mind, because May 15th, my
National
birthday
Chocolate
was not
Chip Day,
the
know.
Due date.
That's right.
I waited for just the right day, but
National Chocolate Chip Day.
Yeah, yeah. But no, it's they're very proud. They think that I, you know, did what I was good at
was
first
was
eating chocolate.
Your passion.
So.
Yeah. How much chocolate do you eat?
A lot, but I get to call it professional development. So.
Okay. I mean, is it breakfast, lunch, and dinner, or just dinner? Or?
I try it at different times of day. I do think the best thing to have for breakfast is chocolate. I don't know how folks get through breakfast without a little bit of it.
Do you have it just straight up, or do you mix it with something?
On your
toast, or maybe?
These are personal questions,
yeah,
I think.
I'll have drinking chocolate sometimes, or I'll have just a piece of chocolate.
Drinking chocolate? What do you mean by that?
Or chocolate croissant. Rather than, not like a hot cocoa mix, but an actual, like, thick-made drinking chocolate that you have to sip it very slowly because it's almost dippable.
With caffeine.
And theobromine, which my necklace, this active stimulant in chocolate is something called theobromine that's similar to caffeine.
Can you hold up to the microphone so nobody can see it? Thank you.
She was showing it to me, Jim.
Okay, so the Chocolate Expo is thechocolateexpo.com.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to find you at Cocoa Beantown, what's the website for that?
CocoaBeantown.com.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah,
You were great, Victoria. You really know your stuff.
Thank you.
And congratulations to all these local makers.
Well, you know
what's
incredible?
Great.
I mean, I don't know anything about chocolate, but they're so different.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. Folks have a whole world to explore in craft chocolate. So if you like your Snickers bars,
get up
no
to
shame,
Wilmington.
But open yourself up to trying these small makers.
thank you very much for coming
this
in.
This is fun.
Thank you so much.
Miss Victoria, it was very much fun and very, very satisfying on the palate, I must say as well. I do. I think there was
a good day for lunch. We had pizza and chocolate.
That's right.
Really...
Well, and we also had your horrible sausage thing you gave me.
Did you have anything to eat before I made it?
No.
Okay,
we were starving because we didn't get our usual free lunch at the Boston Public Library.
And I can't believe you said that. Okay. Newsfeed Cafe is a great place.
It is a great place.
It's a great place.
We usually get
I don't think everybody
company.
Needs to know it's a free lunch.
Well, the company pays for it.
They do.
Yeah, so it's a perk.
Fine. Okay.
It's a perk of going to the library.
Okay, see if you're going to embarrass us anymore before we go to break. Go ahead.
We've been speaking
Victoria,
with Chocolate
Sommelier
and owner of Cocoa Beantown, Victoria Kitchuk. You can get tickets for this weekend's Chocolate Expo in Wilmington, which sounds like it might be really fantastic, at thechocolateexpo.com. That's thechocolateexpo.com. And for more details on Cocoa Beantown, the website, cocoabeantown.com. Cocoabeantown.com. Thank you so much, Victoria, for coming in. Okay, after a quick break, we're going to open the lines and hear from you.
Our goal is, by the way, to get free lunches everywhere we go. I mean, since Marjorie brought it up, if you want us to make an appearance, throw a meal in our direction, we're there. I mean, that is the bottom line.
That is the
bottom
line.
We don't need to get paid.
That's right.
Just give us a free meal,
well,
and we'll be there
down.
At dawn.
You used to get free dinners. Now you're reduced to free lunch,
I do
Jim.
What I
pretty
can.
Pretty soon it'll
yeah.
be free breakfast or free coffee. Anyway, we're going to open the lines and hear from you about a writhing debate in the eco-conscious community. Would you give up a buttery steak for the satisfying crunch of a bug? That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're not at the library. It's our final apology of the day. We will be back on Tuesday. Everything will be fine. And it's a twofer Tuesday, meaning our first Ask the Governor with a new governor. She'll be with us monthly. Maura Healey, noon to 1. Ask the Mayor, an odd time for us, but it is the real time, 1:30 to 2:30. The show will run an extra half hour. That's with Michelle Wu. To close the show, a simple proposition. I think it is. Bugs or beef? This sort of reliable Spanish survey found that 58% of people agree that bugs could become a legitimate meat alternative in the future. That's according to something called the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. Now, respondents were asked if they would consider incorporating insects into their normal diet. Only 16% of people said they were open to it, but the majority of people said they'd be more comfortable if the meal hid the bug's natural shape, meaning it was blended into something. So are you team bug or team beef? And what would get you to make the switch over to the bug's life if it meant saving the planet? We've talked ad nauseum to Corby, Bill McKibben, and others about what the manufacturer, the production of beef is doing to our planet. The number to call is 877-301-8970. Are you part of the 42% who still aren't ready to be eating bugs, or the 58% who pretend that you are? 877-301-8970. Now, I have eaten bugs, Marjorie, and I am actually, once you get over, not live, but we had this discussion a week or so ago, there's a crunchiness to some
there's
bugs.
There's a crunchiness, yeah.
And you know the way you should start? Like at Cardulo's in Harvard Square, they have chocolate-covered ants and other kinds of bugs. You start with that, and then you work your way up. And for somebody who is obsessed with climate change, which you are, to your credit, bugs are for real an alternative to meat and meat production, which could go a long way to saving the planet.
Well, I'll try to work my way up to it, Jim. I think beans will be my interim kind of thing as far as I'm willing to go.
But these are really
rich
in protein.
I know.
No,
I ate them as a dare when I was a kid, chocolate-covered ants or chocolate-covered beetles.
Well, you don't even taste the
crunch.
You
get the crunch. The crunch is there. The little legs are crunching up little heads. You know, little bodies.
Yeah, well, you don't have to say it that. If you say it that way, then people aren't going to eat it. You just say a bug.
Okay.
And don't you remember, we had those two young women from Harvard in about 5 or 6 years ago, And I can't remember. We asked this. How many legs does a bug have? Aren't almost all of them?
I don't know.
They're either six or eight. And their
know
business
how many
was called either
some
six
of them have
legs,
lots of, like centipedes,
or six bugs,
they have lots
or
of legs.
Something like that kind of thing.
So we're laughing at this somewhat.
I'm not
well,
laughing
I'm not
at all.
Okay, Jim's not laughing. I'm a little suspicious that people are going to start giving up their stakes for bugs anytime soon. But there's a great piece by Dylan Matthews in Vox when he talks about how his college friend that was big on eating bugs, and he laughed it off. He thought it was kind of a ridiculous thing. And then she shows up on Shark Tank, and she gets $100,000 investment from Mark Cuban, her company.
Cuban.
Thank you. And her company, you know what it's called, Jim?
No. Bugs.
Chirps Chips.
Oh, I like that.
Chirps Chips sells cricket-based chips all around the world, and apparently 2 billion people around the world already eat bugs in certain parts of Africa. It's big, you know, Madagascar, Tanzania. So I guess it's picking up steam. East Asia, India, Indonesia.
Why are you so do? I don't understand. I mean, the concept is hard, but if you try it, don't you think you can get over? If you are, as I say, I'm praising you for this. If you're as consumed by the notion that the planet is warming as rapidly as it is, and this could go a long way towards slowing that down.
I think you
why
can give up steak
deal?
Without going to
bugs,
beetles. Yeah, I do. Chirp Chips. Oh, one of our staff, Jamie says, our producer says, he's had Chirp Chips and they are terrific. Very crunchy. Ooh, good mouth feel, he says.
Okay, that's, so by the way, here's
crickets. So they made of crickets.
Was that Jamie who just
Jamie,
did that?
Jamie eats crickets.
Speaking of Jamie, you know, before he came to us, he worked at BUR. And back in 2015, Jamie was talking with the chef and eating a turkey burger. So you may say, what's the relevance of that? The turkey burger, you ready for this, was fortified with grasshoppers. Here's Jamie and the chef.
You will taste some of the grasshopper. I'm going to warn you about that. Here they come straight off the grill.
Yeah, here
Let
we go.
Let me know your thought.
It tastes like a turkey burger.
Yes.
But then there's that extra exoskeleton crunch.
Exactly.
Oh, I see a grasshopper.
You see it?
Head just sticking out at me.
Yeah, it's peeking out at
you. I'm halfway through this burger.
Yeah,
all right, I guess
cheeky.
I'm going to go for the head.
Now, that is a problem. I mean, that is that you have to disguise it or hide it or something it. But I by the way, I'm not just saying this for effect. I really think this is an important thing that, in fact, we should have somebody come in who's got a bug thing going. And you probably wouldn't even try them, right?
No, I would not.
Well,
are you going to transition, Jim?
I'm not going to
transition.
You like
a good, nice steak, don't
you? No, I do like it, but I am concerned. Didn't I tell you the other day I went to the Whole Foods at Ink Block? Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Which is a spectacular Whole Foods.
Yep.
And there's this thing called plant something or other, and it's next to the coffee thing. I started talking to the guy, and I had a plant burger, which is the first whole plant burger I've eaten in my whole life. And you know what it was? Terrific.
Well, thanks to Corby Cummer, he's made it almost impossible for me to eat anything anymore, like the story he's done about bacon and pork. And I was going to get a pulled pork sandwich about a month ago, and I thought, I can't do it.
A beetle was wrapped in a piece of bacon, could you do that? I'm serious.
No, I'm just saying, I don't want to eat pork anymore because of all the horrible stories about pigs.
Oh, that's right.
And the horrible stories about chickens and beef and factory farming. The whole thing makes you nauseous, not to mention dairy farming. You hear enough about that. You don't want to have anything to do with milk or yogurt or anything either. So
I think you're getting overwrought
we're getting
by this
back
whole thing.
To where I started, Jim.
Where is it?
Beans.
Beef, that's not our discussion today. Beef or bugs is our discussion. Ellen in Westport, where are you on this issue? Hello.
Hey, hello, Marjorie and Jim. How are you? I'm
oh,
at
this
the beach.
Is
I'm
Ellen.
Loving it. Beautiful
I love
day.
Ellen. Go ahead.
Oh,
what's up?
I am no to the never, never, not, not. I'm a person of color, and I won't even eat pig's feet. There's no way that I would eat ants, bugs, flies, or any of the other grubs. I'd have to be desperate. No.
Well, I think that's
there you
a
go,
little
Ellen.
Close-minded of you, Ellen, don't you think?
What
yeah.
did you say?
Close-minded. You got to think
Ellen.
More broadly.
Well, I'm close-minded, but anything with many legs like that.
Let's talk about pig's feet.
That's a good point. Ellen, thanks for calls.
You know the thing about
always.
Pig's feet? Pig's yeah. feet come in glass jars.
Yeah, they do.
I mean, you're looking at the little hooves in there inside the glass
have to
jar.
You're not just
Ellen.
Ellen
I mean, really,
about
I, you know, who could eat pig's feet? My grandfather used to eat pig's feet
he
all
did.
The time.
Well,
it was
that's
disgusting.
The answer to the question. Somebody
did
could.
Did you used to eat Ellen pig's feet as a child?
No. Never, never. I saw family members eat that stuff. No, I won't eat chicken feet either. No,
yeah.
I like pork. I'll eat a rib anytime.
Anytime.
But the bugs, Heck to the no. I have to be Salvation
to the no.
City.
Okay, Ellen, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Ellen. I think you made your point relatively clear. What is the bug that is on the screen here, whoever posted
that?
That
looks like
that
a
thing.
Centipede.
A centipede. So does anybody, do people, that I would have
oh
a hard,
my God.
That'd be hard. Does anybody eat centipedes? Or can someone look that up and let us know? Dave in a car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up?
Hey, guys, how are you?
Excellent.
So as a foster child, I was kind of forced to eat this raisin bran that had ants in it. And
no, you were, no, that's not true.
Yeah, no, it's true. They didn't believe me, and that's a flavor that, you know, sometimes like a certain scent will bring you back in your childhood, and that is something that I will never, ever forget. But, Jim, you'll be right along with me on this one. The only place that I would ever go as a restaurant and chef that would ever be able to pull it off is Rachel at Nightshade Noodle Bar, who was just nominated for Best Chef. So I think that she'd be able to pull it off, and I would do that in a heartbeat.
We were just talking about Rachel's nomination as Best Chef. Rachel Miller is her name. It's a fabulous place, and Lynn and Dave, obviously you'd think so too. Thanks for the call. By the way, Jamie, who put this up? Jamie, you? These are centipedes as street food. They're on like skewers, you know, straightened out. Look
oh
at Marjorie's
God.
Face. On the I've been to Beijing, and I've just missed them.
Well, when you go back, Jim, you can get a centipede skewer.
They are a little tough on the eyeball, I have to say. I assume that's tough.
Just put a little salt on, you'll be
that's
fine.
That's really, it's a little tough. I was talking tough, and it's a little, well, actually, there they look is another photograph. This is not very helpful on a radio show.
Oh, God.
But they look actually really, really.
They are enormous centipedes.
They look something.
They're like 8-inch centipedes.
Yeah, well,
what
if you're
the heck
hungry,
is the thing next to it? Looks like a horseshoe crab.
Yeah.
Bob in Plymouth, thank you for calling.
Do you know horseshoe crabs are older than the dinosaurs?
I didn't know that.
I'm not sure that's true, but I've been told that.
Yeah, you see
older
them on the beach occasionally. Not
Bob,
as much
sorry
as
to interrupt
to.
You. What's up, Bob?
You know, horseshoe crabs, their blood also is used for
yes.
like blood treatments.
That is true. Something like that, yeah. What's up?
The legendary Jim Browdy and the always wonderful Madrig.
Madrig, I know. Yeah, okay.
I got you twice in 2 days now. I've eaten bugs. I used to freak my kids out if we were like picking up branches in the yard or something and I find a grub in a branch, I'd eat it.
You just eat it live?
Yeah. Just
that's
pop
not
it right in.
And what why is that
pop
exactly?
It right in.
Why?
It's kind of gross and gooey, but you know, it's a little shot of whatever.
Oh
okay.
God.
I mean I've had like ants, they're good dipped in chocolate. I've had chocolate covered ants, I've had chocolate covered grasshoppers,
yeah.
chocolate covered crickets.
Yeah.
You know, like 75% of the world eats bugs.
Yeah, they do.
It doesn't hurt to try. I've had raw mealworms. Those are kind of bad.
No, that'd be a problem
but,
for me. Okay. I think that's about enough,
yeah,
Bob.
Know,
but thank you. Thank you for your comment.
Yes.
The thing is, though, Marjorie, when you use this stuff in cooking, it's all ground up. You're not eating little legs and heads and stuff. It's not crunching like trying to bite your back.
Well, excuse me. I don't think you've seen the those are scorpions and centipedes on skewers.
Yeah.
I think they're not ground up in anything.
I'm not even sure I'd eat one of those big centipedes because I've heard people talk about it, and it's kind of like you bite it and it kind of shoots goo into your mouth.
Oh, God. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Have a nice day.
You too. You too. Yeah, you too. You know, we don't have many bug enthusiasts on the email either, Jim.
What are they saying?
Well, people aren't very excited about it.
Well, they weren't into plant burgers. 5 years ago, either.
But
now,
someone suggested next week we just have the chocolate sommelier. Next week
we have bug person.
Cricket sommelier.
By the way, in all seriousness, get us a bug person in here, bug as food thing, and one of us will show the way. And I think you know, by the way, you just have a squeamish thing about it. You don't.
I do. Remember that, what was a TV show? The $100,000 challenge, whatever it was. People have to eat bugs, live bugs out of a
Oh, there was that show, yeah.
Bucket. Oh, my God. It was disgusting. Yeah. William in the car. Thank you for calling.
Hey, William.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
So my story is a friend of mine spent some time in West Africa. And it's, you know, as I think you already mentioned, it's pretty culturally accepted to eat a lot of bugs over there.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So he befriended someone who came to visit back in New England. They're like, oh, well, you're in New England. You got to have some quintessential New England cuisine. Put a big lobster on his plate. And he said, that is the biggest bug I have ever seen. I'm not going to eat that.
Well, you know, that is an interesting question.
No, it's not an interesting question.
If you're not culturally attuned to a lobster,
the shell.
What is a lobster? Is a bottom dwelling.
That's right.
Whatever
thing.
And
you cut off the shell and take the body parts.
Oh, what are those things? Those crabs. You eat the whole damn thing. You eat, what are those kinds of crabs?
Soft shell crabs.
Soft shell crabs. You eat ever one of those?
No.
Well, I have plenty of times.
Well, good for you, Jim.
They're really good. That was good, William. Thank you for the call. We're advancing nothing in this conversation. Do you know that, by the way? Because you're so close-minded.
Well, apparently there's a place. Do you know about this place in Cambridge? The Plant Pub?
No.
Maybe they have bugs over there. I don't know. Somebody was just saying there's a plant pub in Cambridge that has bugs.
Huh.
Yeah. And a lot of people are saying that has spent some time in Africa. Some sister taught at a school there. And when the locusts came, the school kids would all run outside, grab them out of the air.
Just pop them in?
And eat them.
That is really tough to take.
Oh, God. Okay. Janet says, I'm not overwrought because the horrible lives of the animals we eat should give everyone indigestion. David from New Hampshire. Thank you.
Hello, David.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
So a couple great stories for you. So I lived in Vietnam for a while, and I'd go to these wet markets, you know, where there's slabs of meat and they're just chopping it with a big cleaver. But behind the scenes, you would see these giant boxes of Purdue chicken feet because Americans don't eat chicken feet. So Purdue would package them properly, sanitarily, and send them to places like China and Vietnam. So you'd find these giant, you know, hormone-fed chicken feet in Vietnam for pennies on the dollar. And another great story is I married a Vietnamese woman, and she would eat pork hooves to induce breast milk when our children were born. So, you know,
really?
That's another reason to try things that you're not familiar with.
So if you're having trouble nursing, then you get pork hooves? Is that what you're telling us, David?
You know, she would just do it from the beginning. It was just part of the tradition of, you know, that part of Vietnam that she was from.
Okay. Well,
and then a final one that I'll mention.
Please.
If you ever pass through Cambodia,
there's
these young people. They got these giant, you know, 5-gallon buckets filled with tarantulas. And they're crawling over their bodies and stuff. And the tourists stop and take photos. They try and sell them to you. So if you want to eat tarantulas.
No, Marjorie would love to eat tarantulas.
Oh,
so
God.
She's off to Cambodia this weekend. Thank you for the call.
Okay, our
now,
colleague
Henry.
Henry, yeah.
No, Henry, by the way, he is like a master chef. Henry Santoro.
Yeah.
He, I believe this is a tweet, says, you haven't lived until you've eaten Botswana or Mopane. I don't know if I pronounced it right, worms. I ate one, tasted it for an entire week.
Not a good sign.
One worm has the protein equivalent of 2 porterhouse steaks. And I have to say, he sent us a photograph.
A photograph.
Too.
No,
very,
they look
very
delicious.
Appealing.
Yep.
They really
just
do.
Just dump some salt on them. You'd be all set.
By the way, we're probably destroying a whole important industry. So again, please, Jamie or one of our colleagues, get us some bug.
Yeah, you let me know how it
server
goes, Jim.
Things come in here.
Not me.
Okay, that's it.
We are all done.
We're all done.
Thank you very much for listening to Boston Public Radio. We apologize again to people that came down to the Boston Public Library today. We are hoping to be back, that technically we'll be in charge on Tuesday, where we have a twofer. Our twofer on Tuesday is the new governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and the mayor of the city of Boston from 1:30
to 2:30.
To 1:30 to 2:30.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks to our crew. You want to thank our crew. Aidan Conley, Zoe Matthews, Brendan Deedy. Our engineer is John DeClaw Parker. Brian Bell has been on the boards with us today. Our executive producer is Jamie Bologna. And John DeClaw Parker is our engineer as well. You can tune in Monday for the Ground Truth Project, Charlie Sennett, Mass League of Community Health Centers, and the NAACP's Michael Curry. Head of the Massachusetts Teachers Association.
Oh, this should be
Max
great.
Page,
you and Max Page.
As well as V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, best known for writing the Vagina Monologue. She's got a new memoir out called Reckoning. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browning.
Thanks again for tuning in. Apologies again for the library. Hope you have a great weekend. I hope you can tune in on Monday.